Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on September 30th, 2015. I'm our ruler of time here alongside Rolo T. Chris, it's the last day of September.
It is. It means fall is coming to a head. It means it's 7 o'clock and it's pitch black outside, which is depressing. Mm-hmm. It means it's getting colder, which I don't like. I have to wear pants around the house. None of this is good, Nick. There's nothing possibly good in this scenario.
Well...
Unless that's, like, your lead-in was like, no, September's ending. What a great way to start off October.
Well, stupid kids have to go to school.
That is actually very enjoyable. I do enjoy that children have to go to school.
Suffer.
Yes. And then the ones who don't have to go to school are either so young, I just don't consider them people at this point, or they've now graduated and they are going to be ushered into the workforce where they will very quickly realize that that all their best years are behind them and that all that awaits them is never-ending work until they retire and die.
And none of their dreams will ever come true.
Yeah, dreams are all just a myth. You were born in the wrong generation to be a dreamer.
Should have been a baby boomer.
Yep. At least that's what all my teachers told me. Like, you weren't born at the right time to be a dreamer, Mr. Larios, with your hip-hop and your Brock Lesnar theme song and your John Cena necklace.
You're like, hey, you shut up. That theme song's really catchy.
Yeah, dun, I'm... Dun, 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 dun. I'm doing, like, his shoulder flex thing. Like, you're fat. That's not the same as being strong. I'm like, it is this day, you know.
Have you looked at Brock Lesnar? He is not human. Like,
no, not in the least. No, I mean, there's not much to be excited about. September's end. It just means my runs are going to get later and later. But I did do a half marathon, Nick.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. It was Beat the Blurch. You know the oatmeal? No. Online webcomic. It's done by this guy who comments a lot. It's like he does a lot of like comics on like vocabulary and grammar. He did one on like the mantis shrimp, if you've ever heard of it. It's like this crazy shrimp at the bottom of the ocean that's like,
yeah,
you know, season colors we can't even comprehend, stuff like that. He has one
and it punches stuff really hard.
Yeah, and he has one comic about dogs, and I know you won't care much about that. You can sort of consider it like cats in its own way. But he also does a lot about running, and he started setting up half marathon marathons of 10Ks based around a lot of the jokes of it. It's supposed to be a very fun kind of run. And it was. When you get there, it's like, oh, race photos are going to be free. We're going to have guys in big fat costumes chasing you around, being like, yo, go. There's going to be Nutella sandwiches at rest stations and couches. It's going to be really goofy and fun. And like, I'm waiting in line, and a guy comes up to me, and he gives us marshmallows covered in chocolate and bacon. And I'm like, Jesus. Oh, this is so goofy. This is so fun. This is going to be a very... Not easy, because, you know, a half marathon's never going to be easy, but this is going to be a very relaxing run done by somebody who clearly has run so much in his life. He's an ultra-marathoner himself. Clearly, he would pick a course well-designed for the fact that many of the people who are running this race are fans of his comic who have not run before, and this is their first race. Then cue 13 miles through the most ass-dangerous course I think humanly possible.
Jesus.
It is... 90% a trail run through trails that are about one person wide, so almost all the time you have to go single file, and so much of the course was like steep 45 or sharper degree drops.
Oh, God.
Where the entire trail is covered in like gnarling, twisted branches that form and layer on top of themselves to create like this super narrow stairwell that you have to go down where each, you know, branch that forms a step is smaller than, like, what you basically have to land on each of them on your tippy toes and go from there as you're trying to run full speed down this thing. It was...
Doing, like, expert-level Mario platforming in real life.
It really is. And at that moment, I was like, I guess it's good I have Twitch reflexes from this because First and foremost, I don't know how this hasn't made the news. I know the Pope visit was a big deal, but I feel like there should have been after that, like, the Pope visited Philadelphia, nobody died. A marathon, a quote-unquote fun run marathon was run in New Jersey this weekend, and 18 people broke their legs because the course was absurdly dangerous. I loved the run. I accomplished my half marathon. I did finish it. I felt, you know, very proud of that fact. It was a hell of a course to run through, though. Like, my arches still hurt today just because it is... It's insane how many points there were where I'm like, is this real? Like, did I fall off the real path and this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing? There was, like, a point where you had to go up, essentially, one of those 45-degree inclines now. And there's about the width of the trail is enough that if three average size, it would have to be average or smaller sized men, were like pressed shoulder to shoulder, you could probably get three of them across. And in that trail, the entire middle, which then divoted and like kind of like sloped inwards, was just filled with rocks that just like went into a steep decline, like just like a crevice in the fucking trail. And the other sides, the only path...
In order to cross the finish line, you had to get past three dragons.
It might as well have been. Like, it might as well have been like, oh yeah, and the finish line, there's a bear. He's probably... Alright, he's probably going to attack you, but it's fine. You're still energized. There's cake at the end. For some reason, the end has water at one station and food at the other, so that was ridiculous. And then I get back to my group, sit down, like, oh, your uncle died. And I'm like, this day, you just really know how to kick a man when he's down. But, on the plus side, I did finish, I do have a medal, and I feel accomplished for that and for surviving what may have been the most dangerous half marathon of all time. I feel like if you sent it into the woods on the premise of this being one of those situations like, and we are now going to hunt you for the greatest sport is man, it would be a safer run than this half marathon.
I feel like it would all be worth it if at the end you were awarded the medal by the bear. Like, it just...
Like, the bear at the very end is just like, good effort on you. Really good sprint you put in at the last minute there. Yeah, and it just eats half your arm. Like, oh! He's like, oh, I'm still a bear. Have more brownies covered in bacon and chocolate. I'm like, well, okay. It was an experience, Nick, to say the least. I will say this, I encourage people who want to exercise to go out and run. It's something I think a lot of people can find passion in. It's one of the greatest ways to exercise because it's a sport where you're only really competing against yourself. And if you finish, then you're first. And I think that's a great mentality to have going into it. I think it's a great sport. Do not make your first half marathon to beat the Blurge in New Jersey. I'm just going to tell you that right now. Holy shit.
You are regretful.
No. Yeah, I'm regretful. I'm still proud.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you finished it. It's a great thing to feel a sense of accomplishment over. So.
Yes, but my feet won't forgive me for a couple days just because of how brutalized they got by the end of that. I guess we should talk about manga, though, at this point. Are you sure, Nick? We had such a great series to talk about this week.
So, we did a series called Kurahime for this week's episode. It's about a girl who's a witch who enchants her guns. And also her pistols, you know. Mm. I'm saying she is drawn fetishy with large boobs.
She's Bayonetta, essentially. Bayonetta before
she
Bayonetta.
She is essentially Bayonetta before Bayonetta. The series ran, like, in the 2000s. It's about Kurohime, who is also known as Himeko, who basically, she is so powerful that she thought that she could stand among the gods, and the gods were like, fuck you. And so they cursed her so that she permanently has this childlike form, which goes by the name Himeko, who is this bratty kid. But at the start of the series, she is befriended by this gunman named Zero. And Zero, when he was young, Kurohime saved him from, like, a gang that had just, I think, killed his family. Something like that.
Yeah.
So he basically thinks that Himeko's, or rather Kurihime, is this great hero, and so he has dedicated his life to following her and trying to find her and stuff. And so, despite being a gunner, he is non-violent. He will use his guns to, like, disarm his opponents, and that's just, like, just how good he is. He can actually, like, shoot the weapon out of your hand rather than killing you with his guns. It's ridiculous. So he comes across Himeko, and his determination to protect her from these guys who are trying to get revenge on Kurihime for all the bad stuff she's done causes her to fall in love with him. And it turns out this is the one way to break the curse that was put on her, is to fall in love. So she transforms back into Kurihime and dispatches the people who are attacking them and stuff. But then she gets all haughty and evil again, so she immediately turns back. So this is basically the premise of the series that we start off with, which is Himeko is impressed by something Zero does and is like, oh, that was kind of hot. And she transforms into her adult form.
I love that way of phrase it. That's kind of hot.
So she transforms into her adult form, but then she gets full of herself and then she transforms back because she's not, I guess, fully in love with Zero or something like that.
Well, she's kind of a... I'm trying to think of the PC way to phrase this. She's a real see you next Tuesday, as they say. She's just kind of a mean person who wants
bad, you know?
Who wants people to worship her. She wants companionship in the form of basically servants and slaves. And when Zero does something that she admires, she's like, oh, I have feelings for him and I love him. But then once the danger's passed, or once she realizes how awesome she is, she's like, I'm great. Everyone in the world will serve me. Ah, even Zero will serve me. Great job, Lackey. And then all the love disappears, and she's back to the point where you're like, oh, you're just a greedy, greedy person. No bueno. And she turns back into a little girl. And that's...
And it turns out that this is something that apparently has been going on. Well, she's had this relationship with other followers in the past where they are incredibly devoted to her, and she really just uses them. There's a main character named Onimaru who wants revenge on Kurihime because she abused him for a long time and, like, branded the tattoo for the, like, a kanji for dog on his back. Basically, you're my bitch, lol. Is his giant back tattoo. And she thinks of Zero the same way for the most part, and only occasionally feels a legitimate sense of admiration and love towards him.
Basically, he dies once a week for her, and she's like, oh, I really care about this dude. And I'll shoot him with healing bullets, and then I'll chase the bad guy away. And I'll do that for 3 volumes.
And then stuff gets kind of weird because there's alternate versions and clones and...
It's a series that initially I gave a lot of credit for because it takes what was a stupid idea and it started to give justification to it that I was like, oh, okay, this does go a bit better. Spoilers for people who are curious and don't want Kurihime spoiled for them. But essentially, the premise is at the start, you know, it's this girl, she turns into an adult woman who's a super badass whenever she falls in love. And I kind of sat there, I was like, well, what's the reasoning behind this? Because I feel like it's going to be very silly. And it is silly, but it's understandable in a certain way and does kind of justify the fact that Kurihime's a super mega bitch because she's actually basically like the black chi version of herself. You know, she was originally a noble warrior who hated the gods, went against the gods, was split in half for whatever reason. I'm still not entirely sure why she was split in half. Like, she grabbed the tiger talisman or something. And basically the good side of her was the one with a charitable heart, was made into a god. And the vengeance-seeking side of her was then separated and then sent back down onto Earth with the curse on her by her good half. And I guess that was the idea of her basically purifying her own corruption by basically being like, this side of myself will also find hopefully true love, and then from that, you know, put an end to that idea of like cyclical vengeance or something along those lines. But it was an idea I was like, okay, they at least put some effort into making a plot to how this works. But then as time went on, it kind of went a bit above itself and just continued to expand too much on this with the clones and all that.
And there's time travels. So alternate timelines occur and stuff. And really, it's just like, this wouldn't necessarily be a problem if not for the fact that I don't really care about the characters in any way, shape, or form. I don't feel any desire to get invested in these weird goings on that they have going for them. It's like, why does it matter that Zero has a twin brother, or that he has a dark half, or that Kurohime has another alternate form, or multiple alternate forms, in fact.
I'm more confused by the fact that every so often when she transforms back into Kurohime, she just gets new fetish outfits.
Yeah.
Like, it was like she was Urza for a while. She just kept getting new armors spontaneously. No, it's tough to care about the characters. Our two main characters are Kurohime and Zero. And Kurohime, as we mentioned, she's supposed to be kind of like this unlikable person because she's essentially like the concentrated douchiness of the original Kurohime. And then Zero is just this blank slate of self-sacrifice that exists to be mortally wounded and heroic and then cause, like, the justification for, blam, Kurohime is back and better than ever. Like, he doesn't really have much of a personality beyond that. He's, a nice kid who was saved as a child, fell in love because of that, and now he wants to go out and just be a good person, which is fine. It's just there's not personality beyond that. And it all kind of exists to create more of this sort of Mary Sue character that is Kurohime. Not necessarily in the world, because she does have flaws, but almost like the way she's written. Everyone in the world is just like, she's the most awesome person there is. Have you heard of Kurohime? She's so sexy, she's so smart, she's so strong. And it's one of those worlds where strength is like this incomprehensible thing. Like, magic bullets seem to exist just to fire whatever you need at that particular time that's convenient for you. It's never like, oh, no, there's limits. It's like, no, I shot into the ground. Now the ground's a giant dragon that's going to eat you. Awesome, right?
And also, I mean, I think that the idea of a hero believing something about, you know, having this ideal image in their head of something and wanting to dedicate their lives to, and then finding out it's not at all how they imagined, but then remaining dedicated to it because they believe so strongly in that, that's an idea that you can run with. And I've seen that done in previous series. But, yeah, like I said, Zero isn't a very interesting character. Like, that's basically all he is. It's like, oh, Kurohime is great. You know, she saved my life, and I love her and stuff. And that's kind of it. So he is basically a tool within the series. It's really kind of one of those sort of... This is, you know, if... this is actually going to be an ironic statement because of how the series turns out. But if the genders were reversed... then this would be an incredibly sexist series because he is simply a tool for Kurohime to, one, get stronger and to have something to defend and then care about when he gets killed off.
Yeah, and to love. And it's interesting because you mentioned at the beginning of the series, Zero's supposed to be like this uber badass. Like, he's supposed to be so skilled with his guns that he can shoot your guns out of your hands before you can even use them. Outside of that chapter, I don't recall him really ever doing anything. Like, he exists just to be like, oh no, a missile's heading right towards Kurohime. I'll intercept it with my mouth. Oh, I always loved you. And then she transforms into her badass and saves everybody. It's really all he does. I never really got the impression afterwards. It's like, oh man, what a skilled character.
So yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, well, what's the point then? Why is he supposed to be this awesome badass or whatever if he only loses all the time? It's one of those, you know, informed abilities that are so annoying.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Rocky from Claymore. If after he was like, I came back and, you know, I'm super badass now, if he then never got to do anything, if he was still just as helpless as he was at the start of the series, which they didn't do. Eventually there came times where he would actually contribute meaningfully to fights. But, yeah, it's like, here's... I actually did think a lot of Claymore when I was going through this, and you know, I think you can understand that, because we've got this super badass, white-haired female protagonist, and then the mostly helpless male love interest, who is also younger and so on and so forth. But, for one thing, I really don't like Kurohime's art. The faces look bad. I think they all look ugly. I don't like them.
I think it's a particular style to it, definitely.
And, yeah, it's just like... I don't like Kurohime, the character. I don't really care.
It's
at all.
I think whether or not you can enjoy this series is going to depend heavily on how funny you feel Kurohime is. Because if you don't find she's funny, then it's a slog to get through this series at points. Because so much of the series is based around how she's constantly screaming for food, how she's annoying, how she's yelling at people, how she's been transformed back into a little girl character, how she's tricking people. You know, how she's going to run off and shove Zero with the bill, but then at the end find out she loves him. Like it's just a lot of the same humor for her over and over again. And that stuff just gets kind of old very quickly. Especially just the monthly series. So you get a lot of, not necessarily filler in chapters, but you just get a lot of moments where you kind of repeat the jokes over and over again in one concentrated moment. Because there's just a lot of the same story to fill over and over and over again.
There's one, I guess to give you an idea of how the humor in the series goes, there's one early scene where Zero is thinking about how much of a brat Himeko is compared to how much he loves Kurohime. And so they're camped out in like a cave somewhere and sleeping. And so he's like, oh, this stupid little brat. And Himeko says in her sleep, oh, Zero. And Zero's like, oh, she does care about me. And so he puts the blanket over her and stuff. And then we see Himeko's dream, which is she has him saddled up and is, like, trying to ride him into battle, basically. Like, ah, go on, Zero, my dog, yeah. And that's the joke, is that she only thinks of Zero like an object, like an animal.
Like a mount, yeah.
That's it. That's the joke. You think that's funny?
It might be funny once.
But, yeah, if you don't think that's funny the first time, and instead you just think, wow, what an asshole, like I do, then you're in for a rough ride. So, yeah, I... whatever. Lots of stuff happens. Like I said, there are clones of different characters, and they're travel through time or some bullshit, and so they're alternate versions of characters they encounter, and Zero dies at one point, and so instead to transform, she has this flower that, like, takes away her memories of Zero because, oh, now she really does love him. And then there's an and there are so many Kurohime, so many different versions of Kurohime. It's ridiculous. I think she has 4 alternate forms, I want to say. I don't fucking know.
Too many. Too many alternate forms, I think we can all agree on.
It's too much confusion.
I was waiting for, like, the evil Mexican version of her, like, El or La Kurohime to come in. Like,
yeah.
It's just her with a mustache, like a poncho.
La Princesa Oscula or some shit. I don't actually know how to say. Is it Princesa? I don't fucking know. Anyway, so it's too much confusion to put up with. I can't get no relief. It's annoying. I don't like her. I don't like any of the characters, and I'm not willing to put up with any of the weirdness that happens as a result of it. That's all I can really say about it. I had a really hard time getting through this series and taking anything away from it other than I thought it was annoying.
Yeah, I have trouble outright recommending it to anybody in particular. I feel like if you are able to jump into the first few chapters and... because it's not like I would say definitely don't read it. I just feel like people wouldn't necessarily enjoy it. If it's something that you can get into the first chapters and you're like, oh, this is funny to me, and the premise doesn't, like, weird me out or anything like that, and you're like, Zero's actually, you know, a fine character, I'm not bothered by his blandness or anything like that, I feel like you could enjoy it. It's just, it's a sort of premise and tone that we've seen in other forms of media done better. I've never... played Bayonetta, but from what I understand, Bayonetta actually is a game with a lot of symbolism and, like, rich story depth to it, so I'd almost be like, if you want the same kind of premise, why don't you play that instead? Or I said, why don't you read Claymore, you know, one of those things, so. I don't know. I would not recommend it myself personally, but I don't want to give it, like, a scathing damnation or anything like that, because definitely I don't have the vitriol for it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we've done series that we both really, really hate. It feels like this is beneath our hatred.
it's almost pat, like, yeah, I'm like, it was there. What are you gonna do?
I don't feel strongly enough about it to hate it. So, bah.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all I got.
There you go.
Okay.
Pounded it away.
Recap. Manga recap. Weekly portion.
All your enthusiasm is dead. Like, this series sapped so much from you, Nick. Oh, Bakuman will help you pick it up.
Really? Does anything happen in Bakuman? What was the point of doing this at all? Other than, hey, remember Bakuman?
There's going to be a movie coming out, Nick. It never mind you, Bakuman existed.
Like, we see Nizuma, and he gets in contact with, what was his, Yoshi?
Hattori, or not Hattori. Asuma? Yeah, it is Hattori. It's the other Hattori. There were two Hattoris, right? And he was the other one?
It was either that or he was the other Akira? No, I think he's, whatever. He gets in contact with his Afro manager. His name, I don't fully remember. And he's like, I want to draw a manga for Jump. And he's like, oh yeah, this is great. Yeah, you do that. And he's like, yeah, okay. I mean, it's nice to see Nizuma, but didn't really tell me anything I didn't already know, which really qualifies for the series as a whole. Well, this little mini series as a whole. But it was kind of fun to see some of the characters again. Nothing I did not know already. Like, oh, Hiramaru was miserable at his old job. No one knew that already. Well, Iwase had a crush on Akito. Well, knew that already. Okay.
It was like, you ever seen Muppet Christmas Carol?
Yes. We talked about Muppet Christmas Carol on Week the Manga Recap at least twice before, but I love talking about it, so go ahead.
I've just brought back to the scene where Fozzie Winks gives his speech and Statler and Wardwolf are in the crowd and they're just like, it was dumb! It was meaningless! It was pointless! It was short! We loved it! That's how I feel about this. It was just like, I can't be angry. It was only two chapters, but I'm like, there was no point to this other than just like, there's a movie coming out, guys. Go see it. Except you American audiences, which can't see it.
I think that we're not going to have limited run in America of the Bakuman movie. I'd be kind of surprised if that happened.
I would be floored by it. Like, I imagine it was hard for them, like, a couple theaters to be sold on Dragon Ball Z. They're like, okay, no, this is another movie from Japan. It's live action. It's about the manga industry. They're like, wait, an industry that doesn't even really exist over here? That, like, it's all import? What are you talking about? They're like, but the Death Note guys made it. They're like, what the fuck's a Death Note?
What's a Death Note?
We have to clear the theater. We need another showing of Maze Runner sequel. Like, no, you don't.
We need to run The Defendant, or whatever the fuck the next Divergent.
yeah, the other Emergent series. Emergent, I guess. I don't know. They're all just terrible. We're going to clear the series out for this fucking Pitch Perfect 3.
The popular teen novel Legend? I don't fucking know.
Oh, you know what? I feel like there actually is still going to be... There has to be more in that book series line. I almost feel like I need to look it up. Divergent book series.
They're going to run a third one, I know. I don't remember what it's called. I actually went to see the second one with someone who really wanted to see it.
Allegiant.
Right. And it was the stupidest movie.
The only
good part of it was that Baby Reed Richards was in it. And he is actually a really good actor. So.
Oh, Miles Teller.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, Miles Teller's pretty good. I have nothing against him. It was not the worst movie.
He plays this side-switching asshole.
You don't have to tell me. Great. I have seen Divergent.
Oh, have you?
I paid about $20 to see it because I rented it in Redbox and just took like a week and a half to bother returning it. And it cost me quite a lot of money.
No, he's great. He's the only good part of that movie, I think.
He's a good part of it. It's not a bad movie, I thought, though. It's just not a good movie.
So stupid and boring.
Yeah, I mean, look. Along the lines, like, if we have to get more...
We're better than these people, so I'm just going to execute one who's helpless. It's like, oh, that's good. Okay. I just had some vaguely sexual interrogation, so I need to have sex right now, even though my character's supposed to be 16. Don't show the sex scene.
I'm like, well, what are you gonna do?
Anyhow, yeah. Divergent, not a good movie. Or Insurgent, it was the second one. I haven't seen Divergent, whatever. I don't care. Anyhow, so we see Akito kind of like being like, I knew that I wanted to help write a manga for a living, but I haven't been able to make, you know, any fucking progress on this. I haven't been able to find, you know, someone to do the art, and I can't do the art myself. Then he overhears a bunch of people, pardon me, freaking out over Ishizawa's art. Did you remember Ishizawa?
He was the guy who was like the weird, like perverted dude, right? Like that's all his art was. It was like a lot of...
He draws kind of cutesy stuff. They did talk about him at the beginning of the series, but he also showed up later saying that he would help out Aoki doing sexy stuff, but he was being really creepy about it.
That's what I remember, something like he was a big perv or he would give real skis about stuff.
Mm-hmm. So Aoki was like, oh, you do manga? Can I see your stuff? And he's like, here. And it's just these like weird, cutesy, chibi girls with cat ears for some reason. They all have cat ears.
I think what most amuses me is that someone had to draw these images. So I like to think like Obata, with all of his amazing art styles, like, hey, I need to draw like complete shit. How do I
draw bad again? I don't remember.
So he just went onto DeviantArt and traced it.
He's the next Gene Simmons' son.
Yeah.
Whatever the fuck is
that? That's all he gets is his name. He's not even a person. He just happens to be Gene Simmons' son who just plagiarized Bleach.
And showed up in that one Pepsi Cherry or whatever the fuck it was commercial. So anyhow, he's like, which one of these is the manga? He's like, they all are. And I like how Akita doesn't say, like, your art is shit. He just says, you don't have panels or dialogue or story. It's just character design. And he's like, oh, I'm not at that stage yet. He's like, okay, thanks, here. So that was actually kind of like very...
He's not an asshole.
He's not douchey about it at all. He's just like, your art's shit, stupid moe bullcrap. He's just like, you're not actually doing it. Never mind. Okay. So he's thinking to himself for a while. And then eventually he realizes, like, you know, the only thing that I'm doing now is that I've... You know, I'm now in the same class as Miho. That's all I have to show for my time in high school now. Or middle school, rather. But, you know, she's super pretty, and that makes me happy. But I've come to a realization, which is her and Mashiro keep on doing this stupid thing where they look at each other and then look away blushing, which I'm sure they won't do for the next 10 years. And so he's like, oh, they must really like each other. And so... So he comes to that realization, and then I guess he talks to one of Mashiro's friends from elementary school, and he's like, he's actually a really good artist, but I don't know, he doesn't really do stuff anymore. Maybe he's, like, I don't know, embarrassed about it, so he's drawing badly on purpose or something? I don't know. So Akito is like, I don't know, meh, whatever. He's just kind of watching them for a while, like a weird creeper. Like, he's just constantly watching how Azuki and Mashiro are looking at each other and blushing and looking away through like, the entire school year.
That's and he even does. Notes that's, like, all he does. Like, he's like, why am I going to school?
I love the expression he has, where he's like, what am I doing with my life?
Because at this point, doesn't he realize that Mashiro's an artist, right?
Yeah, why doesn't he talk to him this entire time? They could have had a year's head start. I always just assumed he randomly stumbled across Mashiro's notebook, and that was how he knew he was going to be an artist, and that was why he asked him. And say, you find out, he always suspected Mashiro was an artist, and that just never talked to him about it. Even though he went to Ishizawa, whom he knows nothing about.
Yeah, you know, he had clearly a good strategy for going into this, you know? He wanted to... Thought maybe if I stalk some people, that gives me some good writing material. And it goes from there, yeah.
So eventually, we actually get to the point where the original Bakuman started. And I actually recognize the pose that Mashiro has as he's packing his stuff up. I remember that because of when I edited together my Bakuman video years ago. Went over that page a few times. A few. Anyway.
Just a few, Nick.
Well, when you edit something together, you watch it about 800 times, you know? So.
Yeah.
Anyhow. So, you know how the story pops up. You know, Akito, Mashiro leaves his drawing notebook behind. Akito discovers it. He flips through it. Mashiro comes back, and so he's like, "Oh, you know, help me draw manga, or else I'll embarrass you because you like Miho and stuff." Anyway, turns out some of Mashiro's drawings of Azuki are really creepy.
There's definitely some strange ones, like, oh, here she is looking out a window. Here she is, like, being standing for a class. Like, okay, those are kind of normal. Here she is after she fell and she's hurt herself. Here she is running late to school.
Here she is in her gym outfit. And it's like, I know some of them are just like, oh, she's so pretty. And others are just like, what were you thinking about when you were drawing this year? Were you actually drawing this in class? I think that some guys would notice. Yeah, but eventually it's like, oh, you know, she's actually got, you know, word bubbles and stuff like that. So so Akito's like, this is great. This is the guy who wanted me to be my partner, and that's basically it. It just ends where the original began, with like him pulling the notebook as Mashiro comes into class, and that's even, you know, leave the conversation they had together for the real series, and that's it. And there's a little note at the end, you know, see where the story goes from here in volume one.
I'm just very amused by the point that he drew a shot of her falling and hurting herself. Like, I guess it's supposed to, because it's all playing into the idea that she's so cute. Like that, you know, like that idea, like when a girl hurts themselves, like it's like,
which
that,
ironically,
ow, cute. Kind of, I don't know.
Well, ironically, Mashiro and Akito, when they were first thinking of what manga they wanted to do, they were like, they basically said, like, I don't want to do any of that cutesy stuff with, you know, diseases or, you know, people being hurt, stuff like that. And it's just like, well, why is Mashiro doing all this stuff? He's putting Miho in his G-rated fetish book here. That's the best way to describe it.
I just did hope, like, one of those times where I wish I could, like, continue, like, Apocalypse Dragon, like, I could just insert myself into the end of this series, so Mashiro comes into the classroom and Takagi's like, I want you to draw with me, but no more of this Moe bullshit. Credits. And that's what, like, starts Bakuman. Like, they're like, and now go read Bakuman 1. It was fine. I mean, again, there's nothing to say about it. It was a pointless series, ultimately, but what are you gonna do?
I don't know. Wish we could go see the Bakuman movie, I guess.
Yeah, it'd be kind of cool to see it.
Anyhow, let's move on to Bleach.
Black Clover, God. Nick, sadly.
Right, oh god, yeah, you're completely correct, yes. Black Clover, page 31, The Crimson Lion King. It sounds like a Yu-Gi-Oh card, doesn't it?
I wouldn't be shocked if it is a Yu-Gi-Oh card. I'll look it up, Nick.
I don't think you're going to find it, so... So Figolian has just stepped in order to fight Eyepatch Dude in Asta's stead. But Asta is like, oh no, you know, I'm not gonna, you know, just stand back like a wuss. I'll still fight. And Figolian, like, chops him in the back of the head as he tries to leap into action. He's like, no, you're not. Because, you know, you must, you know, be more aware of your condition. You're obviously not ready for combat. You know, I understand your enthusiasm, but you have to keep a cool head and understand this. If you actually want to accomplish your long-term goal of becoming the Wizard King, then, you know, step aside for now and let me handle this.
Sadly, there is no Crimson Lion King card, but there is a hookah bar in Wilkes-Barre, PA called the Crimson Lion, which I kind of feel inclined to go check out now. Maybe I'll find El Fuego there, or whatever his name is in this series. Fuego Leon. There we go. I got it. I took my one try.
So... Anyhow, he confronts Eyepatch Guy and says, your actions are too scattered for an invasion and too organized for indiscriminate terrorism. So obviously, you're practicing discriminate terrorism, which is also a thing, so whatever. So he's like, yo, who are you? And the Eyepatch Guy says, 6 years ago, I was the top choice for a Magic Knight squad. The names... Radies? Rods? Raids? Reddies? There are so many ways you could pronounce that. I don't know which one's supposed to be. I'm going to say Radies, I guess.
Radies, like Hades?
Yeah, but I have no clue if that's accurate or not. So, Figolian's like, oh, former Magic Knight? Oh, you don't remember me? I guess I wasn't important enough for you people to bother with. And then Figolian immediately remembers who he is. So, okay.
He's like, oh yeah, now I remember the zombie dude.
Right. So, Radio says, you know, they said my wraith magic was dangerous and forbidden, and since I was a commoner, nobody had my back. They exiled me from both the knights and the country, even though my talents were better. Better than the nobles, better than anyone. Wasn't magic supposed to be everything? So that's why I'm avenging myself against those magic knights of the country with this power. And there's narration that says, although there is one other reason, presumably, I guess he's collaborating with other people, and that's the reason he's talking about, I don't know.
Oh, is that supposed to be his internal monologue? It's like, although, yeah, there's another reason. I like to think there's a kind of jerky narrator who's like, yeah, but there's another reason why you're doing it, you know. Like, no one else can hear it. Like, he's just breaking the fourth wall.
Just like Jim Ross coming in to chime in on someone's like, yeah, because he's a jerk or something like that.
Look at this guy over here, asshole. This is kind of an interesting thing. They haven't played a lot with it, because very quickly afterwards, they're just like, you know, what a childish reason you had, and something like that. And I feel like we're supposed to just kind of side with, you know, Fuego de Leon in this. But it does pose a question. Magic's not determined necessarily by anything. It seems almost somewhat random. It seems like, you know, families share magic initial traits, at least. Like, you know, fire families will produce more fire-esque mages. But this idea that there's a magic type that exists, wraith magic or, you know, whatever it might be, certain types of magic that are just banned outright. And it's not like you had a choice in the matter. It's not like you were like, oh, well, I was born and I chose to pick necromancy as my style of magic. Like, you're just born with it. And the magic, you know, knight society just ushers you out. You have no choice in the matter. You're banned from competing in it. You're banned from being a magical knight. It sounds like they almost treat you a little bit like a criminal. You could pose in some interesting commentary about class relationships in this, and the door is open for it. I don't know if that's necessarily where they're going, but I hope they do, because that would prove to be at least interesting. As I said, here, it seems like that's less of where they're going and more like he's just a crazy asshole. And Fuego Leon's like, what a silly reason you gave for this. But I feel like there is an interesting premise that has been presented here.
Well, also he talks about classism, because, you know, it's because specifically he was a peasant that nobody stood up for him. And we've seen that, you know, Yuno and Asta, even after they've joined the Magic Knights, they've had to deal with, you know, classist, you know, stuff going on between them. So, I guess this is supposed to be like, you know, this guy was subject to the same abuse as Asta and Yuno are dealing with. And also he has this type of magic, and Asta's got a weird type of magic too. So what if Asta had happened to have cursed magic or whatever? Would he have been outlawed from the Magic Knights and so on and so forth? So I think that Fagolian, despite the fact that he has shown himself to be, you know, a very noble spirit and willing to give guys a chance and so on and so forth, it seems as though he's not without his bits of ignorance. And
yeah.
So. Anyway, so Fagolian tells Leo and Noah, you know, go. Do you need some help? And Leo says, no, we don't. And they're like, all right, good. You know, finish that opponent of yours off. And then he turns his attention back to Rhaetys and summons this giant fire-breathing lion made of fire. And it breathes fire.
It's a very fire-based dude. He really, if he doesn't get a job here, he can easily go to the next Pokemon region and open up a gym, because he's set up for it.
So, but Rhaetys' next doll just summons this protected dome in order to deflect the flames, and he introduces it as number one Carl. When he was alive, this guy was a defense magic expert, and I added my curse magic to that and made him even tougher to get past. Villian says, you know, do you remember, Asta, what I told you a moment ago? Watch carefully. And he continues to attack Fagolian with fire. He continues to attack Rhaetys with fire. Rhaetys tries to attack him with these weird spear things, I guess? I don't know. And so he's forced to deflect them with a flame shield. And, yeah, he's like, oh, you can't get past me. You can't, you know, handle this combination of my defense and barrage and so on and so forth. What do you want? What are you going to do now? And Fagolian fires basically a fire bullet, which pierces through the shield and goes through Carl's chest. And bleh. basically.
Aww. He killed friend, Nick.
Carl!
Fucking Walking Dead.
So, Carl bursts into flames and is seemingly immediately defeated, and he says, in the instant you attack, for just a moment, the mana of the barrier thins in places, so I aimed for that. I meet with difficult magic every day. Listen well, because you are magic knights, you will find yourselves constantly pitted against powerful enemies and magic. When it happens, if you gaze the ability calmly and maintain a bold fighting spirit, you will never lose! Which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
This guy's awesome. Yeah, and so he really starts talking it down to Radies and says, even if you possess phenomenal abilities and polish them to their fullest, without a just spirit, they're nothing but violence. There is no one who will acknowledge something like that. And that's the end of the chapter. So.
Yeah, it was a fun chapter.
Very, very simple, battle, but I like Thigolian the more we learn about him and see him and stuff. And, yeah. So that's basically what I have to say about it.
Yeah, it could open up some doors to some interesting dilemmas or world building off of this.
But anyhow, now let's move on to Bleach. This series.
Was this another baby hold your hand?
Yeah, it was.
It was.
I think it's the last one.
Oh god, I forgot this scene happened. I got to the title page and
okay. Bleach 644, Baby Hold Your Hand 7, Never Ending My Dream. All right, so
is it two separate words? Never ending. All right, fair enough.
So not never-ending dream, but you are never-ending my dream.
Or never-ending dream done English style.
Never-ending my dream. I don't know how to do this, whatever. English grammar hard. Anyhow, so because Pernita ate the pituitary gland of Nemu, he grew to ridiculous sizes and burst and is exploding. And I guess he's just dead now. He appears to be in tiny pieces now, and Mayuri walked away from him all badass, and he didn't grow another arm and splat Mayuri on the ground, so he is, I guess, now dead. Mayuri then collapses.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, ah, a functioning nerve still remained. It got my legs.
Very convenient. Nothing else, just my legs. Oh, bollocks.
Maybe I should be worried that there's the one nerve left of the super regenerating hand, but oh well.
Oh, that's such an inconvenience. Now I'm going to have to perform emergency surgery on my leg too. Oh, it's fine. Now I have robot legs.
No, apparently I'm helpless on the ground now. Nope, can't move. Nope.
Oh, shouldn't have thought I could just do that all the time.
Oh well. I guess I reached my bullshit limit for today. So, Yumichika and Nikaku come back, and they say, he tells them, all right, listen, onto the remains of the right arm, 30 ken from here, you will find body preservation pods that Nemu brought. If you push the red button on the side, its contents will come out. You two go on ahead with them. Don't worry, it took some time, but they should no longer be zombies. And it's Hitsugaya and Matsumoto, and they're fine now. Because he stuck them in super hyper regeneration tubes.
I just love that these are a thing, and they're just there. This entire giant battle with, like, the multiple forming hands, at no point in time did these things even get displaced slightly. man. Mary's almost, he's almost to that level of Aizen where you're just like, you're so ridiculous. I can't, you're almost parody at this point. I just love that they're just there. They're just there, they're hanging around. You hit a button and it's like, oh, Hitsugaya is back. He won't say anything. They're not gonna acknowledge in this chapter. Like, wasn't that crazy? We were zombies for like 18 months of this fucking manga.
We were technically dead and then undead, but now we're fine.
Yeah.
Yep. No reskin or anything. Speaking of which, by the way, what happened to Kensei and Rose, who were also zombies?
Well, yeah,
did he only have two of these?
Oh, I guarantee those paws are somewhere else, and they'll be revealed at some point, and they'll be like, oh no, Kensei and Rose are fine too. I'm sure everybody was really worried about those guys.
Watch, I'm trying to figure out why Hitsugaya and Matsumoto, did he want the strongest ones to still be his zombies? And if so, why? And it, first of all, if he wanted to keep two of them as zombies, why not keep all four as zombies? Because then he could control four of them and be super powerful. Second, if he is going to regenerate all of them, why did he start with Hitsugaya and Matsumoto? Would it not make sense to have the other two more experienced captains, and Matsumoto is not a captain, so she's definitely the weakest of all four of them, would it not make sense to have the other two go first? Why is Hitsugaya so valuable here in terms of military strength?
I have to assume it's a meta awareness. He's like, he's so popular. He had an entire movie about himself. He got
look
to
at him. I mean, look at how handsome and pretty he is. He's both simultaneously somehow. I don't know.
The Shota boys are just going to go crazy about this.
He's got so many fangirls.
Look at him. Look at his perfectly combed hair. Even though he's been a zombie for so long, his hair is perfectly in place. Science even can't explain that. Trust me, I've been trying to work out a hair gel that will put it all down. You can't make one. It's impossible.
I would have his hair if science could replicate it.
Also, I'd probably put a few light bulbs in it because I need wackier hair than everybody else. But maybe a frisbee that constantly tosses a frisbee to itself. Oh, that'd be great.
Hold on a second, Madarami. Let me actually record this real quick. Note to self. Next weird outfit, have hoodie with Hitsugaya's hair. Okay, now you can move me in.
Put a roller coaster in it. All right, good. We're good to go.
A roller coaster in his costume.
It's just, every time he puts his foot up, there's Hitsugaya's hair, and there's just a roller coaster going through it with little tiny people.
These are actually real people. I shrunk them down to size because I'm a cool maniac.
These are the other Quincy's who survived. See, I didn't kill all of them. I keep some of them around for cruel, sadistic enjoyment.
I'm a good guy.
Hashtag good guy. Hashtag hero. Oh, we've gone so long without even getting to the end.
In a way, I'm going to miss Mayuri so much.
This is probably the end of his character for the series. If this is the final arc, what else can he possibly do?
So, Ikkaku and Yumichika dump him in the now vacant pod and put Zaraki in the other so that they can get healed up. Good! I love how Zaraki got... So... Zaraki beat a brain in a jar, got jumped by four actually not very powerful Quincy's afterward, and then lost. He got healed up by Isane. Then he immediately got his ass kicked. And now he's got to get healed again. Wasn't this guy one of, like, the five super military things that Juhabak was worried about?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be, like, Ichigo, Aizen, Kenpachi, and then Mayuri, and Mayuri again, because there's probably another clone of him. There's probably another clone of him that's just as smart but slightly taller, or some other bullshit.
Soul Society, five special war potentials. It's actually a Google result. Hang on. Who are the five special war potentials? Blah, 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 blah. Said Aizen was one of them. Ichigo's obviously one. Zaraki is one. Mayuri, I would have to assume Mayuri is one. I think.
Mayuri or maybe Urahara? I don't know.
Maybe Urahara. I don't know. So, special war potentials, blah, 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 blah. Leech, five special war potentials. I don't know. Is there a rest of the chapter? I think I'm forgetting. They thank him for saving Zaraki. Mayuri looks down at the brain he got from Nemu that he's got, like, tucked into his robes. And he's like, I have created a Kanpaku from scratch that evolves on its own. I've surpassed you, Kisuke Urahara. Although I can't imagine the look of frustration on your face that makes all the more worth seeing. The next time we meet, I will demonstrate the disparity between you and me. You and I, the two of us. Well...
Oh, hello, naked daughter.
Oh, my daughter's naked. And she's floating in water with me for some reason. Does this mean I'm dead? I don't know.
I assume heaven would have a lot more going on. I'll have to change that. I'll have to... Over there will be the torture facility. And perhaps over there, the unjustified experiments laboratory. Yes, yes. Heaven needs these things, for I am a hero.
Okay, so yeah, it's... Zaraki, Aizen, and Ichigo are the three confirmed ones, and the other two have not been confirmed at all.
I so want to be like fucking Ganju in chat. And everyone's just like, what? He's just like, have you seen Chad? Like, have you seen Chad? He can punch things ridiculously hard. And Ganju...
It's been so long since Yubak showed up, I forgot we did that for him.
I just love sand, as you know. So... I read this recent chapter of Fairy Tail. And there's this desert-themed character. He is a riot. I want one of them in my army who also is desert-themed in his gimmick. I mean, that's the one. We have a furry cowboy hat man. We have a Thor. We have a talking hand. We now need, obviously, a desert character.
If you will.
Yeah, if you can understand.
So, anyway, the other Soul Society group are like, in other words, Shinsui Nurhara's group are like, oh, I just sensed that Captain Kuratsuchi is down, but he should be fine. By the way, are all the assistant captains dead? Because he realized they're being sniped. And so Renji's like, not Ruki and I, we're still here. Neither is Hinamori. And Shinsui's like, and Nanao's still here too. So weird.
Like, can we not see Hinamori? Like, there's no, like, oh, she hasn't been sniped either. Like, how do we know? Why didn't you show her? You show the other ones.
Couldn't waste panels on that. Because as we all know, Kubo is very stringent on preserving panel space. Like that one panel directly above this conversation, which is literally nothing.
It's the fucking sniper mop nuzzle, which you can only tell because there's a slight bit of the inside of the nuzzle, or the muzzle, from the rest of the fucking blackness that is his gun. God.
So, they're wondering what they should do, and Axe's guy is like, I'm gonna shoot you guys, and you're all scared. And Shinsui's like, time to make my move! And Exaxis guy shoots him in the chest, and he's like, no matter how beautifully a pack is unified, it will collapse with a single act of folly by an idiot. I've seen countless packs like that. I was hoping you Soul Reapers wouldn't be one of them. And then Shinsui uses one of his bullshit Shikai powers to suddenly teleport behind him. And he's completely fine. He hasn't been shot at all. And then he cuts the barrel of the sniper rifle off. And he's like, your weapon's mine now, and your life will be next. And that's it.
God, how does Shikai work again? Like, you pick a color each?
He's got two different abilities. Like, one plays children's games, and one does something. So the power he used is explained to be called Darama Sanga Koronda, which is a children's game similar to Red Light, Green Light. Which is how he was able to suddenly teleport, I guess. I don't know. Remember, he did the thing where it was like, if you step on a shadow, you get stabbed. That was one of his powers when he fought against Coyote Star.
Yeah, but he also had one too. It was like, you can only cut one color or something like that.
Right, and so, I think it's like one is random children's abilities, and the other one is the declared a color thing. I'm not sure. Maybe it's always weird mini games with his powers.
He's like, he's got the Mario Party Bankai. He's like, all right, 50 turns later.
Bart?
50 turns.
Oh, God damn it, since we found another bonus star, fuck him!
God damn it, this dude is bullshit! His entire Bankai is bullshit, and it takes forever, just kill me!
This is not his Bankai, it's his Shikai.
Well, his Bankai will be Mario Party, though. That's where it gets to the... That's the next level it goes to. And we're going to read every turn is going to be its own chapter, Nick. So so we're going to be a party of Mario's part 50. Because during a 50-turn battle, Bowser hold my hand or some wacky, like, Bowser in me or some wacky title at the end. And we'll find out Shunsui won because he got the minigame star, the happening star, and the you happen to be Shunsui star, which is an added star they added just into this game.
Ah, oh, God, I'm not really looking forward to this because Shinsui's last fight with a gun-themed guy was so anger-inducing for me. So, yeah, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah, I'm also not excited about it because the last time we had one of these kinds of things, the Coyote Stark fight had so much promise behind it. It was supposed to be the strongest Espada, and it was, like, a complete letdown. It was over in, like, one week or whatever, and there really wasn't anything you got from it. And I feel like that's where we're going to get to, because so much time has been spent with fucking Parnitas and, like, 8 chapters of Mayuri's crazy bullshit, which really kind of reminded me a lot of the ridiculous amount of efforts that had to go into killing Baragon. I feel like we're now going to get the Stark fight, where it's going to be like, oh, X-Axis is super, super strong. Oh, but you killed him, like, 1 week because you cut off a sniper rifle and then you used your Bankai or whatever and, you know, you got away from him. But it's also tough because this is one of the largest characters in Soul Society. He's, you know, he's the captain of everything at this point. So it's tough to buy into this idea that he's going to be threatened by one of the, you know, minor lieutenants. Like, I feel like if he was fighting the balance guy, if he was fighting Hashwalt, I feel like it might be a more intimidating kind of matchup. Like, who knows which way it's going to go. But I feel like it's pretty obvious now that Shunsui can't fall here.
Right. Okay. Fairy Tail?
Yes! Fairy Tail chapter. Ooh, what did I. Not on the right one here, sorry. Just a little bit.
Page. Chapter 454.
Dragon Flight Force and Osprey Force. And the cover page is Evergreen and the other members of that group, whose name I don't bother to remember, playing what looks like some version of Handball. I'm not exactly sure what game it is, but it looks interesting, at the very least. Also, I'll defer this to Derek, our female consultant. I've never heard of playing those kinds of games in that particular outfit, like a tracksuit where you unzip basically all the way down to your breasts. I feel like that would be counterproductive to playing a game. Like, you'd want to just wear a sports bra or something like that. But I don't know. Maybe she makes it work. Also, glasses. That just seems dangerous. You get smacked in the face, you get the broken, no bueno. Anyway, last week, or was it last week? Yeah, it was last week. The invasion happened. It was sooner than everybody expected! Except not, because Mavis actually expected this from the very beginning, Nick!
I just didn't tell you guys!
Yeah, we just needed it for dramatic tension. So, Siegfried uses his big shield barrier thing that he essentially used during the last time the Fighting Festival arc. And they're blasting against it, and they're just like, oh, you know, Sieg's good, but he's just not good enough to hold it against this. And that's when Mavis is like, ah, yes, but this was in my range of prediction. And actually, it's great, because their forces are actually smaller than I anticipated. Let's go, Operation D! Instruct Dragon Flight Force and Osprey Force to commence attack, go! And we cut away over to the cowboy girl, whose name I don't remember, even though they call her Biska 7 times in this chapter. I still don't bother to remember it, because you can't try to tell me these important characters now. She's off in the woods, and we cut away then back up to the desert dude, who's like, aha, fire, fire! And we see these 3 streaking lights coming towards them, and they blow up one of the ships, like, what happened? And we see it's the dragon slayers, Wendy, Gajio, and Natsu, who are up there, and they're, you know, flying through these different things. They're using their what do they call them? Excels? Exceeds? The cats. But that was a proper name for them. Can't remember. Anyway, they're using their fucking cats to fly. And they're bashing through, and what then happens is that you cut down to Biska, and she has this giant cannon, and she uses the magic focusing cannon Jupiter, fires it, Geel, I think was the sand guy's name. He blocks it. He uses his sand. He blocks the attack from destroying the capital ship, but in return, it just causes the attack to spread out and destroy a whole bunch more of his fleet. But he doesn't seem to care about that because he's evil and he's a dickhead. And up to this point, the chapter's actually kind of fine. It works in its own way. You know, the hubris of the bad guy is almost undoing themselves. Then all the dragon slayers land on the ship.
Yes.
And they immediately all get sick and faint.
Oh shoot, we forgot!
And it then cuts back to the fucking guild, and fucking Makarov is strangely the voice of reason here, who's just like, what the fuck, First Master? And she's like, oops, I forgot.
Master Strategist, Mavis Vermilion.
All three of them landed on the ship, and they're just immediately immobilized. They can't do anything because it's a fucking moving ship. At which point, like, he's just like, oh, you know, I'll take care of you guys now. You're fucked. And then, shockingly, their ship gets cut in half. Basically, the three dragon slayers are removed from it because it's now falling. And instead, Urza has landed on the ship. And Jiu even turns. He's like, who are you? And his eyes have veins coming out of them into his skin, which is kind of weird. And she says, I am the one who will cut you down, Sliss. And we cut to Evergreen, who says, on your knees, kneel before Titania, the Fairy Queen. I don't know why. I know why they do that, because that's a callback to when Evergreen and Urza fought, and Evergreen basically beat her by getting really fetishy and being like, strip naked and prostrate yourself before me! I just don't get why Evergreen's speaking here. She's not on the ship.
She has very good, strong hearing. She's got, like, you know, level hearing, Chris.
She's nowhere in the vicinity. No one referenced her. She's not brought up in the rest of this chapter beyond happening to be in the same room Siegfried's in. I don't understand why she comments in it. It's so strange to me.
Well, and also, the Dragon Slayers land on the ship, right? So yes. They're fucked. They land on the ship because the cats dropped them there. And they're then hovering above them all. Why don't they just go back down and pick them up?
I guess because they... I don't know. There's no reason. No one, at no point should they have dropped the Dragon Slayers on a moving vehicle when everybody in the fucking guild knows that's their one weakness.
All they had to do was blow up the ship the same way they blew up the other ships.
It would be like, oh, hey, Superman's going to go help us. He's going to use his laser beams to destroy all those spaceships. Oh, and he'll land on that deck made out of kryptonite. Oh, he's gotten weak. Silly us, we forgot that one fucking thing that's our character's weakness. And it's okay, though, because Urza showed up. Somehow she flew up there, too.
It seems like a... Well, she's got her flying armor on.
I know, but it's...
It seems a super lame way to get the three Dragon Slayers not involved in this. And also, you know, if you're going to have, like, an air strike force, why not have fucking someone else be flown up there? I don't fucking know.
It just seems weird. Like, it worked until the Dragon Slayers got dropped off there. Like, I thought it would have been fine if they're like, no, the Dragon Slayers are essentially like, you know, they're like TIE fighters. You're going to fly them up there, they're going to blast up a couple of those ships. But the ultimate strategy is to use one of our lesser-known characters to have her fire this blast, hopefully destroy the capital ship. But hey, he blocks it. It still ended up taking out most of the fleet. And then we go from there. You know, we finagle it from that point onwards. Have the Dragon Slayers come back, because they're useless, obviously, attacking those ships on foot. Figure it out from there. You know, if Urza was supposed to be up there, like, oh, don't worry, Urza will handle it. It's just so weird that they land on the ship. And clearly that was an instruction given to them by Mavis. Because she's the one who knows, like, oops, I forgot. Just sort of weird there. Otherwise, fine chapter. But, yeah. Very strange.
So, let's move on to Food Wars. Shokugeki no Soma. Chapter 136, Captured Queen. Which actually opens up with Dojima suddenly coming across Joichiro. Soma's father. Mm. And, so, they're like, oh, hey, it's you, yeah, blah, 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 and stuff, and, they do a little bit of catch-up, and Joichiro's like, oh, man, what a coincidence that us two Globetrotters came to the same town the same day for work. Oh, well, it's not a coincidence, come on! You haven't seen me in years! We haven't talked! I thought you might be dead! And, like, he's just plugging his ears. And he's like, they catch up for a while, and they go and get a few drinks,
And Tajima's like, well, I can't stay for much longer because I have to go to a meeting. He's like, oh, come on, skip the meeting. It's going to be boring. Come on. But at that moment, he gets a phone call. And it's like, what? Sir Senzaemon is retiring? A zombie? He's the new dean? And we get this very sudden cutaway to, I guess, it's supposed to be a photograph, I think?
Yeah, I actually was going to bring this up. I started reading the volumes, and when you first get introduced to, what's his name? Dorzamon? What's his name?
Senzaemon.
Jin, I guess is his name.
Dojima.
Dojima. When you first get introduced to him and they reveal, oh, he was the first seat at the school and the second seat was Jochiro, There's a slight cutoff, and I was reading at the time, that is actually an early tease, because at the very end of the names, they actually do say Azami Nakamura.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least looks like it. So this is basically cutting away, revealing that full bit that, yes, he was the third seat on that rather prestigious group of characters, as it seems. A very good year. So, great graduating class.
Yeah, first seat was Dojima, second seat was Joichiro. And they were in their third year, and the third seat, Azami, was only in his first year. So indicating that not only has he always been a really good chef, but he was basically only second fiddle to these guys because they were 2 years ahead of him.
Mm. And I note how rare it is for a first seat to even make it on the Council of Ten. Erin is on it. She's tenth, or she's what, ninth seat? No, tenth.
She's the tenth seat,
and he was
third. So she's only barely on the council at all. Mm. And he was one of the top three in just his first year. I mean, obviously, the first year is not over yet, so, you know, rankings within the council could change potentially. But that's obviously building him up as, yeah, this guy's a super big deal. But then we cut away to Soma and Senzaemon, who, of course, were talking at the end of the last chapter, and Senzaemon, you know, said, oh, you know, I told Joichiro to, you know, sign you up for the academy and so on and so forth. But go back to them, and they've gone out for a jog. Senzaemon's like, I have to drag you along for my exercise routine, so, you know, sorry. But, you know, actually, you know, now that I think about it, you know, being released from the weighty duties of Dean has made me feel lighter in both heart and body. Ha 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 ha. He's not really too worried about his evil son fucking doing this, apparently.
No, he's a very optimistic guy, Nick.
Mm-hmm. I do like that he's not just like, oh no, I'm not the dean anymore. Woe is me. He's just like, oh, well, I got more time.
I'm doing so many chin-ups.
He actually does that too.
Yeah.
So they talk for a bit. And he's like, you know, I want to discuss Erina. In your opinion, what sort of chef is she? And someone says, well, she always seems super uptight about something. And there's narration that immediately pops in, which is usually partly, if not entirely, Soma's fault.
I do love where this goes, though.
Yeah, Senzaemon says, as a child, Erina loved to laugh. We get a flashback to when Erina and Alice were little kids, and Alice had made this dessert for Erina to try, and she's like, it's disgusting. You know, and she now is like, oh, you meanie, I worked so hard to make this. Yeah, but it doesn't taste good. But, thank you. I don't want the rest.
Like, oh, you big fat meanie. Oh my god, you're like big fat meanie pants.
I like how Erina's like, I don't want the rest. You eat it. But I do like how she's like, thank you for making it for me. It's a very simple, like, yeah, obviously she was not always this way, and we see where this goes. And she, you know, laughs a bit, you know, I guess just because she, I guess, was happy to spend time with the cousins.
Yeah, and she's ball-busting, Nick. You know, she's screwing with her a little bit. Like, yeah, I don't want this. Like, oh, you're such a jerk. Like, ah.
Yeah. And then, unfortunately, Alice had to go away. As we learned in the past, she spent a lot of time honing her skills in Europe, and she made a promise with Erina, you know, when I come back with my super awesome skills, I'm going to make you sorry. And Erin was just kind of quiet and doesn't know what to say. And she's like, don't you have anything to say to me? And she says, write to me, you know, while you're gone. Write some letters to me. So, aw, they like you. They love each other because they're family and stuff. Blah, blah, blah. But then time goes by. Alice is removed from her life. And so Azami basically takes Erin under his wing. And he says, you know, do you want to be a good chef? And she says, yeah, I do. And he says, okay, good. Because starting today, I shall teach you proper cooking. And he takes her into this dark room with just a single table. And the only light provided is, like, this one candle. And I guess this is Senzaemon's narration we're hearing, where he says, you know, there Erina had her daily lessons, and slowly but surely learned she did. And, you know, Erina's, you know, at Winnie's ass, are, you know, which of these two dishes is seasoned correctly, she gives this very in-depth analysis. You know, the fatty oils and the one on the right are too pronounced, so the flavor's out of harmony. He's like, good.
I can see now why she's the expert chef and not me, because if it had been me, like, which one's better? I'd be like, this one needs more garlic. You said that about every dish thus far. I'm just saying you could put more garlic in it.
This is ice cream.
I'm just saying there's a little bit of water here, and I don't see garlic powder in it, so fix it.
Zombie's like, that's correct. You know, you chose the right dish. Now take the dish on the right and throw it into this trash bin. And Ariana's like, but I was told you're not supposed to waste food. And Izami takes the dish from her and grabs her hand and just clenches it in his grip and starts to hurt her. And he just says, do it. Throw the food away. And so she does it and she's crying and he's like, that's my good girl. Ugh. He's so evil.
I want Sanji to come in here because this is like a moment he'd be his true hero. He's like, you're wasting food. Also, you're hurting that girl. Also, you're a jerk. And I'm going to kick you in the face. And he kicks him through a wall. And you're like, wow, I mean, you've ruined this series, but this is an awesome moment. You defeated the villain in a flashback, which has caused a real time paradox. But, oh man, it was super sweet when you super kicked him out of here.
Izami instructed her, you must be dispassionate. Have no pity. Speak only of the flavor and whether or not it is correct. Have no mercy for any imperfect dish. Anything your father does not approve of is trash, rubbish, filth. Trash, rubbish, filth. And he's like transformed into this fucking demon ghost hanging over her shoulder as she's crying at this table. It's so terrifying. All he's doing is saying, be really mean to people when you don't like their food, and it's the most evil thing.
It is. It's... It is definitely a very creepy way of presenting it. It's tough, because it's so close to the idea of it, like, just being, like, a relationship that's beyond he's just a really mean chef, and, like, he's warping... Because it does ultimately say, like, he does change who she becomes.
Yeah.
But it's tough because, like, it still is about food. Like, it's still his entire thing. He's not really changing who she is. Like, mentally, he's just like, I'm just giving you a very warped perception about food, which is just going to change you societally and culturally on every other single level.
Well, he made her life about food and made her a judgmental, you know, unfeeling person. So if you devote your entire existence to something, I think it's going to, you know, rub into your behavior and a lot of different stuff.
It's just so, like, it's the greatest, like, character flashback we've had in the past, like, 5 years of this podcast have been from the cooking manga.
Yeah, so, yeah, eventually she got to the point where it was like, yeah, anything he does that my father doesn't approve of is trash, and, you know, from still a very early age, because we see that she's wearing, you know, these, you know, formal kind of Lolita style dress through the whole flashback, and she's like, oh, you know, this dish is disgusting. She's thrown on the ground, you know, how dare you present something so imperfect to me, you know, think on what you've done and repent. And eventually Senzaemon came across this, and so Izami was like, oh, father-in-law, this is regrettable. My teachings are what will raise the divine tongue to perfection. And Senzaemon, you know, said, you're not teaching her, you're brainwashing her. You have become too great a danger, and he disowned her, and so on and so forth. Disowned Izami, and so on and so forth. And that is basically how we got to that point where Erina was more raised by her grandfather than her father, but by the point that happened, it was kind of too late. So.
Yeah. I just like what this flashback does. I love it when you can justify a character who is a bad person and antagonist at the start of the series, but you can tell they're supposed to be something more, and you do it in a way you're like, oh, I really can't blame this character so much. And it's cool seeing that, you know, So has been able to make those cracks in the character before and bring out those more human sides of her. And obviously the characters that have started being around her, Hisako, the sister Alice, Kazuma rather, those characters are starting to bring out like her old side, and then seeing this character come in and just brings this whole new dynamic back into things. It really does create like an interesting scenario and just makes this character a lot more interesting and layered than they were before.
And Sendamanyo notes that. He says, you know, he's having Hisako Arato and many others has helped her greatly in that. But Izami is well aware that her heart still lies trapped within his birdcage. Therein lies my request to you, Soma Yukihira. And he bows deeply to Soma and says, I beg of you, please save my granddaughter. And it's really interesting that the direction that this is taken, because we talked a couple of weeks ago when it's like, oh, Izami is going to be the new dean of the institute. What's he going to do to affect the school? And what are they going to do to, like, oust him from power? Or how long is he going to stay in power? Or what kind of struggles are they going to have to endure? And instead, he's done actually very little with his actual position. And instead, he's just more gone towards influencing Erina. And that's the conflict that we have instead, is just how this family relates to each other. And Senzaemon's not worried about the state of the academy. He's just worried about his granddaughter. Or at least he puts her well-being ahead of the school's. Mm. Which goes to show, I think, how much he cares for her.
It also puts that kind of as the big plot in all this. And it almost makes me wonder, you know, where all these dynamics are going to go. Because it will ultimately have to come back to the school. Because I can't imagine those six council members were all like, yeah, come on in. We all hate Erina to the point we'll just sign the school over to you so you can fuck with her via your presence. Obviously, there's something that they're all going to get from this, and there's going to be a larger plot from it. But it's cool to see that this is an interesting way that we're going to really put the focus of this story. Because it was a premise built on, you know, the first two chapters of the series, that Soma and Erina were kind of like our main characters. I mean, it's sort of tough because Megumi's also been around him, so it's plays into that whole, like, you know, which is, I guess, your secondary protagonist kind of role. But
Erina's done so little, actually, in the series. And this is, like, the first time where she's going to seemingly be heavily involved in the story.
So that's what I kind of like, because it feels like she, by the nature of this, is going to have to be pushed into a bigger role. And it's so strange to me. This almost feels like fucking, like, Enies Lobby. With, like, all the Straw Hats are going to have to band together to save Robin. Like, I feel like that's where this is going to go. Like, I feel like Alice and Hisako are going to be like, we need to fucking save her, so we need to help you take on this council attendant. Or something like that's going to happen.
I don't know about that, but, I mean, it's... I am looking forward to seeing how this goes, because I really have no clue what's going to result from this. So, yeah.
It's very cool. And I've heard some people who haven't liked it because it plays into the male character needing to save a female one.
I totally understand that.
I understand that. I will give it a little bit of leeway, if only because the manga has done in the past broken that, like the Megumi vegetable contest back in the day, where Soma basically made the challenge for her, but the contest then became, you know, she's the lead chef, and she basically had to save herself out of the problem and Soma. So I feel like the manga's given itself enough leeway to show that it's not just going to fall down the root of the male character needs to save the female character. Plus, the two primary side characters in Saving Erina are also going to be female characters, with Alice and Hisako, I feel. So there's at least the chance for it to not be, hopefully, something where a female character is just relegated to damsel in distress and that's the end of it. Hopefully there's as many female protagonists in this as
well, and even if this is a save the girls story, I think that Soma's as a series has had enough, you know, diverse female characters that you can't just be like, oh, it's so typical of that series. You know, for a series that prided itself on delicious looking food that randomly caused women to become naked, it's had a fair amount of actual gender diversity in it. Yeah. So.
So I feel like we can get some interesting stuff out of this.
This storyline could still be phenomenally sexist, don't get me wrong, but I think that, let's just wait and see where it goes. Okay. Mononofu. Game 3, My Own Path, which has very blatant fan service in the first two pages.
It was also the same as like, hey, you know, shogi manga might be hard to sell. What about this chick in her underwear? Yeah, I guess we can market that. We can market that to 13-year-old boys.
Whoop. There's her butt. There's her boobs. There's her underwear. There you go.
I'm so upset. I feel like I should count this, though. This almost is a series where the female lead runs out with toast in her mouth because she's late. She doesn't leave running, but she's late and she's eating toast while she's checking her phone, I presume in a rush. So I'm going to count it on that, like, Sailor Moon-esque, like, scale of, like, female character starts a series off by running out with a piece of toast in her mouth because she's late.
She, like, she moves very quickly. Like, she comes down the stairs in her underwear, and Shinobu is like, shouldn't you cover up before coming downstairs? And she has this great comeback, which is, tell me that once you're a man whose attention I should actually be concerned about.
That is a damning stick. I would just be like, I guess I don't even need balls anymore. I'll just put these away for a little bit.
She's like, I am so confident that you are such a wuss that I don't even think that you will jack off to your memories of this moment. That is how little of a threat I consider you. But they're, I guess, the same age.
Do they have, this is a question I guess for any Japanese, guys, do they have high school uniforms in there with shirts like that? Like, for a moment in that shot, it looks like that shirt belongs in, like, a fetish store or something like that. Like, it stops right at, like, her navel.
It is really weird. I was actually thinking this about her uniform because we see the boy's uniform is, you know, pants and a jacket and stuff. Traditional, I guess, Japanese schoolboy uniform for high schoolers. But her uniform is basically the same thing, except it's got double-breasted jacket, and she has a sailor fuka that she wears over it, and also the jacket turns into a skirt. It's quite weird.
It's an interesting ensemble, I'll give them that.
It's a very weird combination of stuff that goes into a uniform. Anyhow, so they go to the entrance ceremony, which I guess seems to indicate that Shinobu and Pigtail Girl, whose name escapes me, are the same age? I forget if they actually established that before.
Minato, yeah, I believe... I don't know if they established that they were the same age, but it makes sense to keep her... I'm shocked that Keishi, at least they didn't really show it in this, aren't also the same age, but I feel like if you're going to create a supporting cast around this, Minato is probably the most important character out of that group to put around Shinobu's age to kind of give him, like, one, a love interest, but two, like, a rival around that point, so she seems to have the most prominent personality in their group.
Mm-hmm. She stands out because she's very in your face. So,
yeah.
So they go to the entrance ceremony at the start of the school year. Shinobu is such a dork that he's actually taking notes about the principal's opening lecture, which I think is great. He's so fucking studious and shit that he actually takes notes on the one thing. Like, when I went into college, we were all given this book to read that was called Mountains Beyond Mountains. And we were told to read it before the first day of school. And it was like, why? Because you should. It's like, okay, but why do we have to read it before the start of school? Because. And it's like, well, you're not going to test me on this. And I know it because we're not all going to have the same class. So this is going to go into the back of my bookcase and never see the light of day. So Shinobu is like the guy who actually read that book and prepared for a test that's never going to happen.
Very crafty.
So anyhow, he's just kind of going about his day. Stumbles across a student who is nicknamed the Binder Man because he's constantly carrying a binder around. And he bumps into him, and everything in the binder goes flying. All the notes go scattering everywhere.
Yeah, a very well-drawn scene, by the way.
With the way the pages are scattered through the air and stuff?
Yeah, and the way it's kind of, like, drawn, when they get an edge to the, or an angle to the actual panel itself to kind of give it, like, a sweeping, just aesthetic to it naturally.
And so this guy's name is Rindo. And so Shinobu says, I'm so sorry, you know, I'll help you gather all the pages back up. And Rindo says, nah, no problem. And he just starts to walk away. And he's like, no, really, help, let me help you. And he reaches out to grab him. And he accidentally grabs his belt, pulls his pants down.
Teehee.
It exposes his strawberry patterned boxers. And so, bizarrely enough, Rindo looks down at Shinobu and says, "Pull them up." And Shinobu does this, and he says, "Right, that's a good boy."
"You never saw anything. Go away."
But just like, he tells him to pull them up and then says, "That's a good boy." It's like, is this the start of the yaoi part of the series all of a sudden?
Maybe it's another series. They're like, look, let's get into another audience here. Let's start hitting them as well. A little fan service here for the boys. And we'll get the real fan service in there for the those who appreciate a little boy-on-boy action, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm just saying, to our presumably zero listeners in Japan itself, if you have...
We have them, Nick. We do have a couple listeners in Japan.
Oh.
I have to assume it's Mr. Jump himself, who's just like, "Yar! I love them boys on their podcast! They always be shitting on Bleach! Yar!"
"I keep on making it real small in all the group photos, but they keep on running... What is it with him and his stupid full-page spreads? It's wasting me ink, Yar!"
"We only have so much of it. The blue whale we extracted from is nearly dry." Like, you don't get ink from a whale. "What's my whaling business been doing all these years?"
"Yar.
Just killing whales, sir." "Oh, yar, that'd be very sad."
But I suppose I am a pirate.
"Yeah, I've got to do something one way or another, yeah."
Actually, pirates don't go into the whaling business. They just, you know... Maybe they steal from whalers. "Well, then I suppose I've done that, then."
"Then I suppose I'll be robbing my own whale in business later today, then. Yarr!"
Yeah, so to those of us of you who might be in Japan and are planning to, like, go to fucking Comic-Con after this or some shit like that, don't be surprised that the very first Mononofu to hit the shelves is a Rindo Shinobu yaoi manga built around... the time Shinobu pulled down his pants and exposed his boxers. Mm-hmm. It seems like something that would be very easy to fetishize. Easier even than Twin Tails Underwear Girl. Anyway. Rindo's notes that he took that flew out of his binder are a recurring thing in this chapter. Shinobu is like, "Oh wow, they're so dirty and weird and you could barely read them and stuff like that. Why did he take all of these?" and so on and so forth. But then he's like, "Oh well, I gotta go find Shogi Club." And he goes and sees an advertisement on the door that says, "No beginners allowed," in the extra notes. "But I've had some pretty intense experiences over the past few days. That makes me experienced." Which is a surprisingly arrogant thing for this character to say, I would think. Considering all of the, you know, "Oh no, I can't do anything," that he had at the start of the series. I don't know.
Yeah.
"I'm totally experienced now. I've had 12 matches. That's all you need." So he goes in. Room's basically empty, except that Rindo is there. He's like, "I'm the only member here." "Oh no, it's you from before." And Shinobu's like, "Oh, Mr. Strawberry." It's like, "I'll kill you for saying that."
"I will murder you."
And then because the room is abandoned, they just don't actually play Shogi. They just bone. That's what happened anyway.
Whoa, Nick. You create a bold new manga.
Tell me that's not how the doujin goes. Anyhow, so...
If Annalisa were still here right now, she'd be writing it for you. Maybe drawing the first couple pages.
Oh, God. So, Shinobu is like, "Oh, well, I ran to you again, so I could still give you these notes back." And you're like, "No, don't worry. I've already memorized all of those." And it's a really thick stack of paper, so he's like, "Really? You memorized all this? Okay. Well... anyhow, I'd like to join the club and compete in the city tournament." And he's like, "All right, well, let's see how you stand. Play me." And Shinobu's like, "Okay." Moves a tile. "Get out."
"Okay, bye."
Well, he kicks him out. He's like, "Like I said, you know, no beginners allowed. I can't be distracted by a weakling like you hanging around." Shuts him out the door, slams it in his face. Shinobu opens the door. He slams it in his face again. So Shinobu gets this weird fucking look on his face with, like, veins in his forehead throbbing out. He's, like, biting both his top and bottom lip at the same time or something like that. So weird. He runs into Pigtail's underwear girl, who's not in her underwear. She's in her full uniform.
It'd be weird if she was running around school in her underwear. I feel like at that point she'd be like, there's gotta be one dude in the school who threatens you at that point.
He just comes in. like every guy she comes across, like a fucking gang comes to her and like, hey, you coming around here? And she's like, yeah, well, if anyone here was worth actually worrying about, then maybe I would put my clothes on. They're like, oh, our fragile masculinity.
You've shattered it all.
So, anyhow, he complains, like, you know, I guess off panel he explains what happened. And he says, you know, oh, he kicked me out of it for one move. And she says, well, it actually makes sense because those who know Shogi, you know, 90% of first moves are either pawn to 2-6 or pawn to 7-6. And so Shinobi was like, oh, okay.
Oh, gee willikers, that's super swell.
So she says, so what was your first move? And he says, I copied Keishi and moved my king forward. And I says, well, that's just because the king is all he had with his 10-piece handicap. Can't believe that you did that. He's like, oh, okay.
I guess I really am a bum.
So she says, what matters most is that the game suits you, so just don't go down the path you've chosen for yourself. And Shinobi's like,
very encouraging words from her. After she like shit on him for quite a bit, she comes in with like, yeah, just keep playing, you know, you'll do what you do.
Yeah. I like how she's just like, don't be put off by such a stupid criticism. You're an idiot, but who cares? You know, just keep on going. And so he's like, yeah! And he thinks to himself, you know, what the fuck do I need to actually join his club for, basically? Because he actually thinks, like, if he's the only member of the Shogi Club, I might as well start my own Shogi Club, too, and I'll be in the exact same position he's in. So, and I won't be, you know, telling people not to join me, so fuck him, you know. Miyano goes back to the apartment, though, and she actually takes Shinobu's bag with her. But he, I guess, just unloaded it on her because it would be inconvenient for him to take with him. Anyway, the point is that because he took her bag back, because she took his, rather, bag back, that means she's got all of Rindo's notes. And so everyone, you know, starts to study over them and stuff like that. And Keishi looks at them. And, anyhow, Shinobi goes into the club room and he's like, you know, I'm gonna start my own Shogi Club. And you're going to let me stay here. He's like, no! He's like, no, well, no, I don't care. I'm going to stay here, and I'm not going to worry if I have your permission or not, because you don't have any say over the matter. You're not the boss of me. And when he said, you know, when he's like, well, what do you want to do this? So, you know, why do you want to enter the club so badly? Shinobu says, because I want to test my skills and become a pro. And he actually fucking punches him. It's this one tiny little panel, be like, punches him in the side of the head and starts grabbing his shoulders and shaking him up and down. He's like, you're so violent. Jesus Christ. But Shinobu was just, like, ignoring him. And, yeah. So he's, like, studying over problems and stuff. And eventually he's like, oh, what the fuck is with this guy? And but he notices that while he's practicing his shogi problems, he's smiling to himself. He's like, oh, who the hell smiles while playing? And then we cut back to the apartment, and they're like, oh, Rindo. You mean Rindo Fujikawa? And they're like, oh, you've heard of him, Ginga? Yeah, okay. So they're like, oh, he's the grandson of a former Meijin, and blah, 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 blah. They talk about his backstory a little bit, and Minato says, yeah, you know, I played him once as a kid. He was still strong back then. They talk about a tournament that he participated in that's actually named after his grandfather, who's super famous. And then who is this headphones dude?
The headphones guy. I think that's what we just decided to call him.
Anyhow. Keishi is like, so I guess that he failed after, I guess he quit the game after failing to win the tournament then. And headphones guy's like, no, he won. I saw it on the news at the time. Because apparently junior shogi tournaments show up on the news all the time. Or I tune into Shogi ESPN or something like that.
Yeah, ESPN 3, which is just Shogi channel.
I didn't even mean to do that. Shogi ESPN, that's great. Fuck. Okay.
Really, quick, Nick, Chris, quick, get to the patent office. I need to patent that joke.
So he's like, yeah, but he won the tournament, but then he disappeared. And they're like, oh, I think that these notes are actually records from that match, the final of the Fujikawa Cup. He was facing Alba Yurimine. What an incredible match. Look, Alba-kun's final move was Bishop to 3-7. Fujikawa-kun had been attacking relentlessly up until then, but with this one bold move, it looked like Alba-kun would counterattack. And this was a battle between middle schoolers? Yeah.
Immediately after, though, Alba-kun resigned and Fujikawa-kun won. What could have happened? I don't know, but the owner of these records has been searching this whole time, searching for Fujikawa's hidden route to victory. And so, basically, Fujikawa, Rindo, as he is fighting with Shinobu in the Shogi Club, he actually recreates the match, essentially, with him. I guess he just manipulates the situation so that they have the exact same setup, because I guess this is just a habit of his. He's trying to find this answer that he's searching for. And so Shinobu kind of stares at the boy for a long time, and he's like, oh, why is this guy taking so long? Oh, no, wait. Oh, that's what happens, right? He's recreating the game, and then Shinobu notices, and he's staring at the game. And I forgot how this went down. My apologies. And so Rina's like, hey, you know, leave me alone. I'm trying to reflect on a past match, and you're in my way. And Shinobu says, yeah, but you keep on stopping at this moment here. And if it were me, and he reaches for the board, and Rina's like, hey, stop of it! And he grabs the bishop and recreates the move that Alba did. And while this is going on, they're kind of discussing Shinobu at the apartment. And punk-looking guy is like, he's a noob, so he's really tedious. You can't sing his praise much on the whole, but in the end game, it's like a switch flips. It's like, oh, this guy can see the checkmate. You put that in the most obscure terms possible to try and make him sound cool, didn't you?
Okay, she's like, it's what I do.
And it's like if you said, like, about a really good soccer player, he's like, you know, sometimes when he's out on the field, something happens, and it's like, oh, this guy knows how to score a goal.
I kicked the ball, and it went into the goal. Great job.
So that's how you win the game. Yes, thank you for your observation.
He's like a great quarterback. He just scans the field, and he sees that if he throws this ball, it will go into this guy's hands, and it will be a catch to progress yards forward. First down. Yeah. Like, that doesn't explain why he's a great quarterback. Every quarterback, theoretically, would be doing that.
That is the ideal for every person who plays this game, isn't it? So, Rindo is like, oh, how did he know Alba's move? Has he read the records? No, it doesn't seem like that. Who is this guy? And he's like, all right. Play me. I'll see what you've got this time. I was like, okay. So, I understand the point of, like, okay, he impressed him because it seemed like Rindo was going to win. There was no way that anyone could possibly see a way out. But this great player that he's been obsessing over did manage to find something that looked like he was going to win. And then Shinobu, same thing. So, that's what's impressed him. I get that whole point. Mm-hmm. Some of the execution is a little wonky and weird. But
it was a little tough to kind of read on my first time through. Yeah. But I think it's important that they've introduced a rival figure for Shinobu.
Yes.
And that kind of helps to make the podcast seem, or the podcast, the manga seem a bit more interesting.
Well, because we talk about the series, it makes the podcast better too. So
yeah, it works. It's a double layer kind of thing.
I kind of like this chapter. I'm not crazy on the series, but I'm kind of liking it more as time goes by. And unfortunately, we've reached the end of the jump starts. We're basically done with it, unless American readers are super high on this and it gets brought in permanently.
It's actually not impossible. I think the guys at Jump are actually pretty excited for it, so they might do it. I know they wanted to have another sports series in there, so it might be popular enough to get it. Plus, a couple series have been ending or leaving or things like that, so they might want to bolster the ranks of the magazine a little bit.
Anyway, yeah, that's all basically what I have to say about that.
Yeah, no, good chapter.
My Hero Academia, number 60, gear up for final exams. Last time, of course, we had, you know, Deku have that very important discussion with All Might, but then at the end of it, oh yeah, you've got to have your final exams, and there's not a lot of time left before then. And we start things off with the whole class basically reacting, oh, we've only got a week before the final exams happen. And I actually love the fuck out of how these next few pages unfold as we are basically informed who are the smart and good students. And there are tons of surprises through, like, the entire revelation.
Like, they revealed the pervert kids, like, 9, and they're like, characters like you are only lovable, they're morons. If you're actually pretty smart, it just makes you annoying and weird.
And you're just kind of like,
Ah, such is life.
He's this annoying face. He's like, he's one of the most annoying characters in the world. But
he's actually fairly smart, yeah.
There's something so amusing about the fact that he's not a complete idiot either.
Yeah, there's, because there's 20 students in this class, and we're, I think we've given the rankings on all of them. And, so, like, Kaminari and Ashido are ranked 20th and 19th, so last and next to last, respectively. And even a Crowhead guy, whose name escapes me at the moment, he's only ranked 14th.
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember
something
exactly.
Around those lines. And so they're like, oh, man, you know, before... They're both, you know, going like, oh, between the festival and the internship, I forgot to study. And he's like, yeah, me too. He's like, with a dark, serious character like you, I thought you'd be kind of studious and smart, but apparently not. And then we get introduced, like, Deku is fourth, which makes sense. Ida is second, that makes sense. Todoroki is fifth, which is a little surprising, but not so much.
It's almost surprising it's so low, because you think a guy like him who's just so naturally talented and gifted, everything would be at the top, but... Fit's actually pretty high up there, considering basically everyone else above him is, like, defined by the fact that they're rather studious or they're, you know, a super intelligent character.
Right.
Except for Bakugo, who's somehow third.
I have no fucking clue. Bakugo's third! He's right above Deku!
I guess it just fulfills that, like, never-ending thing of, like, Bakugo's just slightly better than Deku at everything.
And then he's never satisfied. And then fucking Momo is ranked number one. And it's just like, oh, that's rather weird. And she's like, yeah, I can help you guys out and studying and stuff, but, you know, the practical exam, that's another story. She feels all gloomy and stuff. And a whole bunch of the students kind of flock to her. And you're like, you know, I'm not as bad as them, but, you know, how about you help me and stuff like that? You know, can you help me with math? Can you help me with kanji? And she's like, oh, people are coming to me. I'm, like, popular. Yeah, let's study together and stuff.
It's like Baby Five. Like, people need me.
Oh. And then fucking, oh, God, I always forget this guy's name because it's so weird.
Tetsu.
It's such a weird name. Yeah, he's like, oh. He's like, man, that's what virtue looks like. And he's ranked 15th. He looks over to Bakugo, who's ranked 30. He's like, I've got virtue too. I'll tutor you till you're dead.
It's very amusing that this dude was third overall.
I fucking love Bakugo. Oh, God. And there's stuff like, you know, Suyu is like ranked 6th. Actually, I'm kind of surprised that Uraraka is ranked as low as she is, because she's, like, in the double digits.
Yeah, I actually was kind of surprised about that, because usually when you have a female character in a series, they tend to be like, oh, well, they're the smart one. And it's not saying she's dumb, it's just she's, like, below average by their rankings, so it's a bit surprising that we kind of get that revelation on that.
Yeah, she's remarkably average for her position, I guess, in the story, but I guess that's sort of the point. She's a little bit of the... She's a little bit of the Megumi of the series, isn't she?
Hmm.
But, you know, everyone's eating at lunch and discussing the kind of their plans. Like, okay, you know, I guess the academic tests are just going to draw from what we learned in class. That's manageable. And Deku's like, but what about the practical? We have no idea how that's going to go. But Ida says, oh, well, you know, I can't imagine it will consist of anything particularly unusual. By the way, has Ida always had square-shaped word bubbles?
I think so, yeah. Ida tends to have them.
I guess that's just a recurring thing for him in non-serious moments.
Yeah, like he
gets
just
a little
sounds
bit
like
robotic.
A robot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, people are like, oh, what are we going to do? And so on and so forth. Monoma comes across Deku and accidentally on purpose bumps Deku with his elbow as he walks by. He's like, oh, I'm sorry. My tray just couldn't get around that big head of yours. What an asshole.
Do we know this guy?
Is he the guy that Deku fought? No. I guess he's new. Yeah. I don't know. But he's like, you know, I hear you guys ran into the Hero Killer. I guess the sports festival wasn't enough. You just keep getting attention with one stunt after another, huh, Class A? But now it's looking like that attention isn't all it's cracked up to be. It's starting to get dangerous, isn't it? Pretty scary. I'm just worried that one of these days we're all going to get caught up in some of your antics. So scary! And a girl comes up behind him and, like, shots him in the back of the neck. And she's like, shut up. He's like, don't joke around. You know, didn't you hear what happened to Ida? Which is like, oh, that's nice of her.
Yeah, very nice character.
It's Kendo. I guess that this is one of those things. I guess these are characters that were introduced at the start of the sports festival
we missed because it was like that jump between when we read the series and when it got picked up.
Mm-hmm. And I do remember, I actually did go back and read that gap, but it's just not as fresh in my mind. It was just kind of like, oh, okay, whatever this happened. It didn't leave too much of an impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
She says, oh, by the way, you know, I hear that this is going to be a battle against robots for the practical exam. And Deku asks, well, how do you know that? Oh, I know a student who told me. And Deku starts mumbling to himself, oh, preliminary intel gathering is just one aspect of the exam. Of course. Why not just ask second or third years? Why didn't I think of that? He's like, okay. So she drags off Monoma and continues to scold him as they walk away. And so the entire class is, you know, relaxes. They're like, oh, we just have to take on robots. Okay, whatever. And the entire class kind of relaxes, like, well, you know, we'll just, you know, study for the written exam and that'll be it. But then Bakugo is like, you know, I'm just going to blast him. Who, you know, what's the big deal, you morons? And he then addresses Deku and says, it seems like you're starting to manage that quirk of yours. By the way, stop pissing me off with all these stunts. And he says, I'm not looking for some hollow victory like at the sports festival. When it comes to our term grades, like it or not, I'm going to crush you into dust. I'll open the gulf between us so wide, it'll kill you dead. And you too, Todoroki. How is someone who talks so stupidly so smart?
It'll kill you dead. It's not something. It's an interesting fact to bring up about him, because it definitely... something that Horikoshi had to have thought about intently when he made that decision. So maybe Bakugo's not as dumb as we keep thinking he is.
Well, there have been hints, you know, for a long time now of there being more depth to him than initially appears. Like the way that he respectfully fought against Uraraka and he got serious against her because he knew she was really giving it her all. And was pushing her limits, and the way that even though he had that intense fight with Todoroki, who was so completely unsatisfied with the way it happened because he knew that he was holding back against him and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that side of him makes him such an interesting character and an interesting rival for Deku, who is just concerned with being a good hero, and he doesn't really measure himself against his classmates so much. And the homeroom teacher kind of observes, I guess, this confrontation that goes on. And he's like, oh, you're going south a lot faster than I thought. Which indicates, I guess, that he's kind of worried they might be going a bit to the dark side. Because obviously his grades aren't a problem.
Yeah.
And his practical skills aren't a problem. So he's really concerned about his behavior. But we get a montage of everyone studying, staying up late, you know, for intense study sessions. Then going through the written exams. Bakugo looks bored. And I guess everyone passes, or thinks that they did well, because even Kaminari and Ashido are like, oh, Momo, yeah, and they're celebrating and stuff. And then we go to the day of the practical exam, and so everyone, of course, gets suited up, and their superhero costumes, and their teachers address them and say, you know, it is possible to fail at this exam. If you want to attend the training camp, you can't mess this up. And, he continues on by saying, you know, you guys probably asked around, so you might think you have a vague idea of how this will go. And they're like, yeah, it's a robot rumble. And immediately Ashido is like, yeah, we're going to go on summer vacation, have fireworks and curry and truth or dare and stuff. But then, weirdly, very weirdly, the principal of the school, who I don't think we've actually talked about this guy before, but he is an anthropomorphic giant hamster with a giant fucking scar over his right eye in a suit. And he pops out from their homeroom teacher's weird bandage scarf thing. Apparently he was just creeping around inside of it. And he has to, like, scale down his body using the bandages as, like, a rope. It's such a weird sight. Anyhow. Anyway, we get a little bit of a flashback to the teachers talking with each other and how they were worried about, you know, a villain revival and stuff like that. So... they're like, you know, we can't just have them, you know, fight robots robots were conceived, the robots that we have to fight against them were conceived of as a means to stave off claims and suspicions that people were being harmed in our entrance exams. So they're like, okay, well then, what are we going to do? And we cut back to the president, and the principal says we're going to focus battles on battles against flesh and blood opponents. It is critical that our teaching simulates practical experience as closely as possible. As such, you students will be pairing up and fighting one of the teachers you see here. And so everyone's like, oh, shit. And he starts to announce their pairings, which have already been decided, and also their assigned teachers have already been decided before they came here. So, like, Todoroki and Yayorozu are going to go up against their homeroom teacher. And then next, Midoriya is with Bakugo.
That's the craziest part this scenario will definitely have.
This is the biggest twist. I mean, because, Bakugo was so dead set on defeating Deku in the practical exam, and now he has to work together with him. That's the twist, right? And your opponent will be me, and it's All Might. Well, shit!
A very interesting twist there. I'm very curious to see where they're going to go with this. I feel like we're going to get a big little mini arc in this, and maybe we'll get something out of Bakugo here.
Yeah, I mean, there's just having these three go up against each other is very interesting, because of course we have the Bakugo and Deku rivalry, but also, the concern that Deku is going to have to one day surpass All Might because he's inherited his powers and is presumably going to be stronger than him eventually one day. And also, Bakugo had set his sights on All Might from the very beginning as someone to, basically as the standard to be a hero. So, very interesting. And I look forward to seeing this go down.
Yes, absolutely.
So yeah, that's My Hero Academia for this week.
One Piece time!
Nisekoi had very interesting facial expressions at certain points, and they're going to bust up the wedding!
I guess. Yes, and it turns out she's not the bad person after all. Chapter 801!
Okay, Chapter 801, opening speech! So... Shinobu takes notes on the opening speech from the... Oh, wait, never mind. Oh, fuck. lame joke, I'm sorry. So, get a bit of a montage. Mostly just kind of people sort of reacting to, we're free now, basically. Although it starts off in a very weird manner as we get Cypher Pole Aegis Zero, which... Is this who I think it is?
Yes, this is without a doubt Rob Lucci, the lead member of CP9. And it's Bam Dam with him.
Because you can see Lucci's goatee, and it's like, what? It's him!
Well, he also has Satori with him, who also has a mask on, like the gimmick that the bird always dressed like him. I'm more interested in the fact that Spam Dam's working for him. I thought Spam Dam would forever be a humongous asshole, but I guess this is maybe their chance to redeem. Because
got a promotion, apparently.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know exactly what the deal with this is, because we did see CP0 originally at the way beginning of the Dressrosa arc. They, walked by Robin, and she, ran away from them. I don't recall the members looking like this, and I thought it was the idea that, oh, this is the top tier. We did get a side story where, I can't remember if it was all the members of the group, I think it was maybe all the members besides Rob, but I think actually he was actually a part of it. They left the CP9, and they joined a zoo, I think. they went off and they had their own wacky adventure, and it kind of left that they had left the CP9. So I'd be interested to find out if this is actually an official part, because I do recall CP0, I don't remember the Aegis part, as being part of it, though, so I wonder if they're, a splinter cell within it, or what's essentially going on here.
He does show up in that, cover page mini-arc. I'm looking up some stuff here. Oh, apparently, I guess he actually showed up at some point recently, because he's actually popped up in the anime, too.
Oh!
It's not his first appearance wearing the mask and stuff. I guess we just didn't notice because it must have been, a background detail.
Well, it's very cool. I always thought Lucci was one of my favorite villains of the series. I'm glad to see him back and doing something. It's interesting to see where they're going to go with this, because I thought he was a character who, if he was going to be involved in, I really thought he's a good guy, and that's maybe still what they're kind of getting at. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see where they're going to go with this. Apparently he's talking to Kaku. I think I heard some people mention that the way the person's text that he speaks with is in Japanese is very similar to the way Kaku always spoke.
Yeah. And I'm very interested in this because I mean, next to, I think, Crocodile, which he is one of my favorite villains in the series, and I would love for him to have one of those kind of, he had his main arc where he was defeated by Luffy, but he's still around and doing stuff like Crocodile got to have.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, after they just are kind of talking about stuff, and they're like, oh, you know, there's something, you know, all this stuff that they were smuggling was stolen, all the military weapons left in the underground port were stolen after everything happened. There was some sort of organization at work here, trying to figure out what happened. But then we get to much more festive activities of Viola's, you know, back to dancing and stuff, but she's actually happy about it, and it's not weirdly, like, sexual anymore, I guess.
I don't think that was a part of it before, was it?
It seemed like she was dancing because it was kind of like a slave.
Oh, like a cover kind of deal. Okay.
She's actually dancing for fun now, so. As opposed to,
be all subservient
to Doflamingo type of thing.
No need to seduce Sanji anymore.
Right. Which she didn't really have to try that hard.
No, she didn't.
But everyone's celebrating and stuff. They're crying with happiness and so on and so forth. And then Riku actually says, you know, I'm going to suggest to you good people. And the Tauntaun actually officially reveal themselves to everyone so that everyone can live together in harmony and so on and so forth. We also see that Leo is commissioning some people to build something for him. A ship, I guess, probably.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's what it's supposed to be.
So,
because they're the only group here that came from the islands. So they're the only ones without ships,
right? So presumably they need a ship so that they can actually go on the seas and help Luffy, as opposed to if you ever come back here, we'll help out.
He's like, bitch, I got Bellamy. I don't need you.
They're doing stuff together, and they also are building statues. There's a statue next to Kairos now of Luffy in his Lucy disguise, and then next to him, there's Usopp making his scared tongue stick out face.
I love this too, because the entire time it's going on, there's this narration of those who visit this land may find themselves surprised by the adorable sight of precious little Tantadas naturally coexisting with people throughout the city. This is the land of love, passion, and fairies. Dressrosa. And it's a nice little, like, closing bit to, you know, put an end to the book that is the Dressrosa arc. Because I truly feel that this is the end of it now. It's almost like a little ironic echo to the way that this island was introduced to us. Like, it's a land of mystery and passion and toys and of fairies. And it's like, now it's the same sort of thing. They're like, it's an island of passion and love and fairies, and, you know, it's Dressrosa.
But without a horrible hidden dark side anymore.
Yeah, they're like, now there's actual, that's good fairies and good stuff, and the toys aren't people who have been trapped by an evil devil fruit user. Like, it's like, oh, no, this is fun now. Like, I like the way they kind of, like, Oda kind of closed it there. And we cut away to a very long Joker speech.
Also, there is a kid in the foreground who is wearing a Bartholomew Kuma shirt.
That is, I did not notice that, and that's actually somewhat interesting. Maybe they are trying to brand the pacifistas?
I don't know.
Because there's definitely more than one of them at this point.
Oh, yeah.
But they've advanced. But they've advanced. I don't know if the movie, and I know the movie kind of showed off a couple things before the manga's gotten to kind of get to them, but they showed off the new pacifistas, and they don't look like Kuma spot on for spot on anymore.
Huh. Okay.
Now, it might have just been something the movie did with that, but I assume that those were, like, kind of canon decisions that went into it.
So we cut to the Navy, and so Fujitora is sailing with Sengoku and stuff, and Otsuru is watching over Doflamingo in his cell. And so Doflamingo's like, you know, this was your final chance. If he had sided with me and helped crush those kids, it wouldn't have come to this. I was the one holding the reins on all the monsters in this world. You shouldn't have taken me down. Mark my words, you will rue this mistake. And very kind of creepy, you know, speech thing. He's like, you know, everything's going to go to hell now, basically. And he's very confident in himself, even though, you know, he's all chained up in Sea Stone and so on and so forth. And he says, you know, what do you think happens to monsters when they've lost their food and the leash is gone? Is there anyone standing atop this sea now? Who rules this stretch of water? Is it one of the four emperors of the sea? Perhaps the seven warlords who use their trickery to get by.
The seven warlords who, by the way, are down to four, and one of them's Buggy. So.
And one of them was me.
Well, yeah, so I mean, they're down to four now, because he's gone. Trafical Law has been disbanded from it as well. And at this point, it's just... Blackbeard's out, so it's just Kuma, Mihawk, Hancock, and Buggy. So that's actually something that I'm kind of interested in, is are those spots going to start getting filled now? And I'm wondering if maybe there isn't even a little foreshadowing with the fact that we see ex-Drake Law so close up to where they are. I wonder if maybe he might get added into that group.
Added back in?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know why you had to say it. So like, you're an idiot, Chris.
Well, they just kicked him out, is my point.
Not X-Law. Sorry, X-Drake. X-Drake.
Okay.
Sorry. He has a weird name, but that's why I got confused. Sorry. No,
it's like, but Law just kicked out.
Yeah. He really openly opposed the world government. I don't know why you think they let... sorry, X-Drake, I think, might maybe join. They let him in there.
He names all of those, and then he says, oh, and then there's the forces of justice, the Navy reigns supreme, and the Revolutionary Army, the will of the people, is stocked with fighters to be reckoned with. And the people of the D, who have smoldered away beneath the currents of history, when will they show themselves, and where? Who will aid whom? Who will betray whom? Find out next week on One Piece!
It is, like, a pretty compelling speech, though.
But he finishes all this by saying, you tell those celestial dragons in Mary Joa, you will be dragged from your lofty perch. It's been 25 years since Gold Roger became the first man to conquer the Grand Line. His rival Whitebeard sat before the throne, but never upon it. And what about now? The number of pirates has swelled, but there's still just the one seat, sitting empty. Do you see where I'm going with this? This is going to kick off the greatest battle for power in the history of pirate kind.
Very cool little speech.
And then at the end of it, he says, by the way, if I'm going to Impel Down, give me a subscription to the daily paper, and that'll keep me from getting bored. So, I guess he just wants to content himself with watching how shit go down for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, then we cut over to some people who have sighted the Navy battleships, and they're like, oh, wow, what's going on here? It's like, looks like we can't seize Joker, so shall we return, Captain Jack? Why would we? Of course we're going to do it!
It's fun, Johnny Depp.
Who the hell do you think I am? Mm.
Well, he is a member of Kaido's crew, as we can see, or someone affiliated with him. He's flying his flag. Mm-hmm. And it almost looks like he's sailing a ship, made for him, too, with the figurehead being the big mast with horns. So, interesting.
We then cut over to Luffy and company, who are now right.
It's the Mr. Luffy Go.
I love this. So Bartolomeo's ship is the Mr. Luffy Go, which is a fairly large ship. The mast has a sort of Going Merry head at the base of it. And
the ship itself is designed like the Going Merry.
And the hood ornament, so to speak, is in the image of Luffy with his arm stretching out along the perimeter of the ship. So great. And Usopp is like, why does this look more like Luffy's ship than ours? And Bartolomeo was like, oh, that's such a nice compliment. It wasn't a compliment! a whole bunch of the people who have pledged themselves to Luffy, we see, have taken little shards of the Beaver card. And also, fucking Bellamy took one, too. And he says, you know, I'm not going to be your follower, but I'll take a piece just in case. It's a nice little note for him to leave on his own.
Because he's eventually going to become a regular Straw Hat, Nick.
I don't know about that, but it's nice to see that he and Luffy are leaving on very good terms.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they set their separate ways. But, of course, Luffy and company are still separated from the Sunny Go, so they're just traveling with Bartolomeo for a little while. Now, the next big development that happens is that everyone's bounties have been updated, as Zoro sees in the paper. And Luffy's like, oh, really? And Bartolomeo says, oh, you didn't know! I've got all the posters hanging up in my chamber, so right along this way! And
He throws out real quick, like, oh, and Law, I threw out your bounty post temperatures raised to 500. And Law's just like, whatever, I don't even care about my bounty. Like, real soon there.
Bartolomeo's like, also, yours went up too, but I threw it out, because fuck you, you're not a Straw Hat. He fucking rolls out a red carpet for them to go to his chamber,
where all of the posters are like individually framed and put on glass with their autographs to the left, and you can't really tell whose is who necessarily, except you can definitely tell Luffy's is the one that just says me. Zoro just wrote sword. I think Frankie's is the one with the star underneath that I can't make out enough of the other two to say. But I absolutely love the joke that Luffy is asked to autograph something and he just writes me.
I honestly don't know if that one's funnier than Zoro's that says sword or not. Oh, God. Also, all of Bartolomeo's followers are just as fanatic about Luffy, which I think is great, too. And yeah, we see all the bounties have gone up. Luffy also has 500 million. He's got a cool picture. Zoro's gone up to 320 million. Robin's has gone up to 130 million.
And Frankie's, it's a picture of her as an adult now.
Frankie's is up to 94 million. And he's like, oh, and it's got General Frankie on the cover. That's great. And Usopp's is this, like, super, super freaked out, passed out expression. And it says, God, Usopp. So he's at 200 million.
That is awesome.
He was just like, oh, they're going to come for me, but I'm also kind of happy.
That picture sucks, though.
And Frankie's like, how come you got such a great raise? Why am I the only one who's under 100 billion? This sucks. He's strangling him. And Sanji's is actually a picture of him now, Nami's got this, like, glamour photo taken of her. Chopper is still freaked out of her food. It's only 100 berries. And Brooks is a fucking concert poster.
83 million. It is cool, because you can still glean a little bit from the numbers. I mean, obviously, like, Usopp being 200 million is at various scale. But it is cool to see, like, oh, yeah, Nami's still low on there. Frankie and Brooke, like, you can kind of gauge a little bit from those numbers. Sanji's still right up there. I think
Sanji's kind of, because he attacked Doflamingo, but because they've been separated from the rest of the group, they're still kind of holding steady other than that.
They raised everyone in the group's bounties, regardless of what they did. I think Sanji's may be just the acts that he's done, maybe, or have finally gotten him grace. Because I think for a while he was actually just a bit below Robin.
He's gone up 100 million, I think, since the last time.
So yeah, it's a pretty big jump up, and now he'd be considered one of the supernovas if we did it again.
Right, he's, oh, technically Robin would be, too.
Usopp. And Usopp, yeah.
And you know, Bartolomeo says, you know, in addition to those who displayed their menace especially well in this battle, everyone got a minimum bump of 50 million berries, except for Chopper. And he's like, and that includes us, so, which implies that everyone who has sworn under Luffy has really high bounties now, which means that he's got a really heavy reputation now.
Yes.
But he also says, oh, and did you notice this? There's something weird here on Mr. Blackleg Sanji's poster, which says that he is only to be taken alive. It's very curious, and that's the note we close out on, which I guess is just... This must imply that there are weird conditions under which his bounty has gone up.
So, I feel like Sanji does a lot of cool things. A lot of Sanji's relationship with bounty posters have been jokes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a gag here where Sanji sexually harassed or just made some lewd remark or did something to someone high up in the world government order. I would find it hilarious if it turned out the purple tiger actually turned out to be a female character and Sanji just like was like annoyingly creepy and annoying to her, and she's just like, I hate this guy so much, I want him brought in alive so I can kill him, and that's what like just causes Bang to shoot up.
I didn't even think of that, the possibility that it has something to do with what the other Straw Hats have been up to that's raised his bounty. So.
Yeah.
Good chapter. Not incredibly
eventful. Sorry, Green Tiger. Purple Ox. That's his name.
Not incredibly eventful chapter, but nice to see a little bit of a stepping stone. It's nice to have a little bit of a resolution, an additional resolution for the Kingdom of Dressrosa. And it was a very entertaining one. So, yes. Yeah. Zwan, and very briefly discuss Salon the Summoner, I guess.
He's still an asshole.
He's still an asshole. Chapter 2, Salmon Kun is evil? Which I'm surprised that that's shocking information. He's continued to bother Teshigawara. He has added a gremlin spirit to attack her, so it like messes with her phone and screws up all their alarms and stuff like that. And he continues to explain his weird obsession with corrupting Teshigawara by saying, by the way, demons are attracted to you because you are such a good person that you are causing greater good in the world. Each time you help someone out of the goodness of your heart, you make the world a slightly nicer place. And to certain demons, this is terribly inconvenient. So I'll say this right now. You're going to be targeted by demons again, and you're going to be killed. So before that happens, you should really become an evil person. Stop being good, or the haters will kill you like the good person you are. Which is a really weird line. And Teshigawara's friend, Kimura, shows up and is like, oh, are you guys hanging out after school because you're a couple? Teehee, blah, blah, blah. Guys are jealous because they are Teshigawara's fans. She is attacked by a demon who pulls her soul out. Samon says, oh, she did it. The demon did it because it was actually going for you, Teshigawara, somehow. I don't fucking know. And so Teshigawara is like, help her. And he says, no, I don't like you, so I'm not going to help you. I'll obviously, you know, I'm going to protect you from being killed, but nope. Why should I save the friend of someone I don't like? Blah, 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 blah. He's an asshole. He helps her. He says that she's evil, but she's not. Then he agrees to help her because she says, I don't care if I'm a good person. I just want to save her. And he's like, oh, that sounds like desire. That's an evil thing. Why is that evil? Oh, fuck.
He's such a weird, douchey character. I don't get a lot of the logic in this. I really kind of, like, skimmed through reading this the first time through, and even reading through it again, I was like, what is the point of this?
It seems pointless, and I think it's going to last. And we have one more chapter just to cover. That's all.
Whatever. Yeah.
Toriko!
If you want to talk about a series, though, I have no idea what happened.
What the fuck happened? Gourmet 3-4, the Blue Nitro's goal. Fucking Super Demon Acacia heard that, like, they're preparing the final meal or something like that. He launched out a whole bunch of the creatures we saw earlier. I guess they're trying to gather the full chorus that he's after. Then Jiro showed up, but it's not actually Jiro because he looks all young.
And there's, like, an Afro Blue Nitro at one point.
And he's... They're like, oh, get him. And he's like, oh, I guess I'll reveal myself. And he digs into his own heart with like some sort of his knocking, I guess. And he's like, I'll kill the acacia for you. And if you get in my way, you're going to die. And they're like, oh, don't get fool yourself. Oh, really? Jiro? It's actually spelled Jiro. Because there's different ways you can spell that in Japanese.
Yeah, and it means two wolf in the way he wants it to be spelled or something like that.
He says, I'm the Masa that used to be called the Ferocious Beast. And he gets all demonic looking with super scraggly hair and sharp teeth. And I used to eat lizards all the time back in the day. You guys are my favorite snack. And then we cut over to Area 7. In other words, Bambina's place. And one of the weird blobby things that Acacia sent out has landed there. And it's caught Bambina's attention. That's the end of Toriko. Yay.
The only thing I want to note is it's something I feel like is going to play into the story at some point. So it's good to note it. The Blue Nitros make a note that in order to completely lock up a demon's cells along with their memories, you must kill it, cook it, and pack it in a golden can. And the way you must do it is you need to wait for it to be in its invincible complete form. So apparently all of the parts of Acacia's full course menu essentially combine into like a Voltron-like object. I'm not sure if it's supposed to be...
all form the tongue.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's supposed to be like... No, symbolically it forms it, or if they're like, no, literally all the fucking food will form a creature of some kind.
I do like the detail put into it, because there's one that forms each leg, that's four. Mm. There's one that forms the body, one that forms the heart, and then not one that forms the head. The head is part of the torso, but there's one individually for the brain and one for the tongue.
Yes. Because it is Toriko.
So everything is confusing and weird because it's Toriko, and that's basically it. Yeah.
And there was sadly, no World Trigger this week. I'm bummed by that.
It's sad because, like, first of all, we have to end on Toriko, which we've been speeding through every week for the past, like, month. And this one was a very big, like, the Blue Nighters explained their ultimate goal, which is to completely revive and restore Acacia so that they can actually kill him and seal Neo away. It's weird. I guess, I don't really completely understand it, but this is part of their goal for world domination. They have to revive and then kill. Okay. Yeah, that's it for this week, Weekly Manga Recap, then.
Yeah.
That's
going to do it.
I'm going to be so happy when we get World Trigger again next week, but for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us for the show. We record live on twitch.tv/realty, normally Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change our schedules and change also where we record it, so to stay updated on that stuff, just follow us on Twitter. He is at Relati, I'm at YRuler of Time, and also you can follow at WMR Podcast for updates and stuff. So follow all those, basically. Yes. Also, check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. You can also check out our episodes on iTunes, and make sure that you leave a comment or rating on there so we can beat the woodworkers.
And we did get one. This is actually one I feel like someone updated there, because I believe we've done this gentleman before, but I will give credit to AG Superman, who says, I love listening to his podcast. It talks about One Piece, and hearing Nick's fantastic Shaggy impersonation is great. You two remind me of an ITM podcast assembled to talk about comics. If you read this, you are number one in my book. Well, sir, you are number one in our book.
I forget how the Shaggy impression actually came up. Was I doing it for a character, or did
I just feel like do it? I feel like we were doing it for a character at first. What? I can't remember who it was.
I've been thinking about watching some of our older episodes, so maybe I'll come across that while I'm reviewing them. I don't know. We want to extend a thanks to our Patreon supporters, because you guys help us to do extra stuff for the show. We do bonus episodes and such like. We are actually coming up on our next milestone goal, which will be live commentaries of anime movies.
We are absurdly close to it at this point. We're less than $20 away.
We're not going to try an eBay. I'm just pointing it out. You know, thank you guys for doing this. You guys allow us to do additional stuff. We're very close to giving you even more content. And yeah.
And to note, we did the September bonus pod, the top 10 sports to be a manga. So if you are a champion sport, you can grab that now. If you, are listening to this live and you wanted to, you can still grab that then. But then starting in October, we're going to start for the next bonus pod, which we announced on the last one, but we'll announce it here for everybody in case this, you know, gets you want to listen, you know, chip in so you can get it. We're going to be doing a new series. We're going to give it a test run here called a Weekly Manga Recap Lives, where we're going to essentially live read a couple different chapters from the past month or so. So if there are any particular chapters that you guys really want us to go through and read, kind of like we did with the Gakkyo Hotei final chapters, let us know. I imagine there are some out there that people, you know, already have an inclination towards. I know a lot of people like this One Piece chapter, so maybe that's what you want to see, or the Food War chapter where a zombie revealed himself in his master plan. Like, that might, you know, very likely be one. So just let us know what chapters you want to see. I don't know, maybe, like, we'll do three or four. We'll kind of have to play it by ear on that. But, yeah, so you can kind of cast your votes for that. Maybe I'll throw up a straw poll or something like that going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And do want to give a thanks also to our new patrons, Ali B. And I feel like your name exists to screw me up. Ali B. Alshek. I don't know how to pronounce your last name in the slightest. I apologize. Also to Ryan Lang and Nazara. So thank you, all of you. It is greatly appreciated.
If you have questions you want us to answer on our next Q&A episode, or suggestions for future manga for us to read, or you have just general criticisms you would like to make of the show, then you can send those to our email address, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com, and we'll go over those. And finally, we'd like to extend a special thanks to those who helped to produce extra stuff for us. Steve Mann, the title card artist, and also Infamous Planet and Felix Dark create visual editions of the podcast. Thank you to all three of you guys. You guys are awesome.
Yes, absolutely.
Next week will be the first Weekly Manga Recap for October 2015, which...
Nick, I want us to embrace Halloween month.
Okay.
I'm going to try to, like, make spooky music and have, like... I feel like when we do, like, and now it's time for the weekly... The recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap for, like, now it's time... We change the words around, so it's like, and now it's time for the spooky recap of spooky manga. We'll come up with something much better at the time, like wacky Halloween puns or something like that. Like, it's time for Bleach, chapter 498. Booby, won't you hold my hand, part 9. I don't know why I did the Hitler reference in that.
Nine is a spooky number, right?
Well, I did 9, like, you know, 9 fucking...
9, 9!
Like, I'm kind of 9 in German. Like, I'm like, yeah, Nazis are a part of Halloween, right?
Sometimes.
I'm so sorry.
Anyhow, to start off October, I'm not sure if we'll have this done in time for next week, but we were encouraged to try and do a few longer series for Halloween month. So we're going to be doing that. We've had this recommended multiple times. It's finally come time for this. We're going to do Monster by Naoki Urasawa.
Oh, yay! I was going to do it if you didn't do it. I was going to be like, Nick, I don't care how long this takes, but you're doing it. Makes it all the better. I'm excited for this.
Okay, cool. So that should be a good discussion. Very highly acclaimed, popular series. So, looking forward to talking about it.
It's going to be spooky, Nick. All right, we need to come up with some horror puns now.
No.
I saw One's Pieces in the chat. I don't like that. That sounds like a porno. Like, we're coming up with porno titles. Should we make that a month, Nick? Slutty, like, a month? Like, Skanky Timber or something like that? We just do a bunch just of skeezy bunch manga?
Of veggie series. Honestly, I don't think that we need... Well...
We started off okay with Kurohime.
I did say at one point I wanted us to do more themed months, so maybe. I just don't know which month in particular is associated with sluttiness. Other than Halloween, honestly.
You don't need to necessarily, like, relate to a holiday that currently exists. We can just do it, like, make a theme month of it. We define it ourselves, Nick. Like, Christmas in July. We just make it happen. We make it a thing. And yeah, I think we start with
Skank Timber. Reaching for the stars with this goal, aren't we?
I think we start with Skank Timber.
Skank Timber.
Fan service February is probably better, but I like Skank Timber.
Well, we just did September. We can't do it now.
Can't we do Skanktember in November?
In utter